Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the today's Darwin Seminar of the LSE. It's the job of the chairman to provide a sort of frame for the painting, which has no intrinsic interest or relevance in itself, but demarcates the space of the outside world from the little space in which we're going to hear intellectual content. And I thought one relevant way to do that would be to mention to you an incident which I gleaned from Darwin's correspondence, showing Darwin as a domestic man rather than as a towering genius. His daughter Henrietta had diphtheria in 1860, the year after The Origin of Species was published, and was still recovering in the first half of 1861. And in correspondence with J.D. Hooker, the distinguished botanist, Hooker recommended that Etty should be basted in cod liver oil. So what we now take for vitamins actually covered all over her skin with cod liver oil, and he promised Darwin that this was a way to help her improve. Darwin made one attempt to escape this prescription, saying to Hooker, well, it was a little bit much to ask this 9-year-old girl to be basted in cod liver oil. And was he really sure that it would do good? Hooker assured him it would. And so Etty took to being basted in cod liver oil to help her recovery. And in the part I've just been reading, Darwin, in replying to Hooker, assures him that the being basted in cod liver oil really does help Etty's condition. My preliminary view of this is that Darwin is simply being human. He's following what other people think are good ideas, and in assuring Hooker that it worked, is reflecting his own sense that he's done something rather nasty, and it's better have been worthwhile, or it was a bad thing to do. And saying to Hooker, he's really saying to himself, this made an improvement. Now, nowadays, there are many remedies of this kind which people take for no really good reason. And I like to think that in this respect, Darwin was merely being an ordinary mortal, and that he was simply falling into traps or making mistakes of the kind that we all make. As Darwin was right in everything, almost, it is still possible that the next generation, based in cod liver oil, may turn out to be the right cure for diphtheria. So that's what I'll say about Darwin in this first half as Darwin the domestic man. And it would be too hard to find an intellectual thread which everyone in the audience was able to appreciate, my excuse. Our first speaker today is David Hull, who's the Dressler Professor in the Humanities at Northwestern University. And he is a distinguished philosopher, both in the sense of being a philosopher who's distinguished as that. He's also distinguished by being one of the few philosophers that biologists take seriously. Most philosophers have a rather superior attitude to the subjects that they study and appear to biologists never really to come to grips with it. And David Hull is one of those whose views about how biology works seem to be informed by an understanding of biology. And so I'm very pleased that he's here to talk to us about how science works, and I shall listen with interest to that. So I'd like to ask David to give his talk now.
Although the title doesn't indicate it, the paper is about how science works, especially in evolutionary analysis of science, and the role that invisible hand mechanisms play in science. Right now we're going through a period where science is debunked, and in the midst of all this debunking, we tend to lose sight of the fact that science has been the most successful social institution in the history of the world. Of course, science doesn't have to work very well to be the most successful social institution. I mean, it's like being the tallest midget in the freak show. But much more can be said on behalf of science. If the primary goal of science is to get us to understand the empirical world, the natural world, as well as we can. It's gone beyond anybody's wildest dreams. You go back 200 years ago and show an early scientist what we know now, and they would say, we can't believe you have gone so far. Of course, very little of this knowledge has trickled down to the general public. The vast majority of the people in the world have never heard of evolutionary theory. If you think that's false, it's because you're thinking of first world people. But even among first world people, the vast majority don't believe it. I don't know how well trickle-down economics works, but trickle-down knowledge doesn't seem to work at all. Also, I'm aware that the vast majority of the world has not benefited, and some have been harmed, by technology. But that's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in primarily science as an intellectual activity. A few years back, I published a book and argued that part of the explanation for science being so successful was its social organization. It did not make me a social constructivist or social anything else. I thought that the social structure of science was very important to science doing what it said it did. Now, I was aware at the time that the social structure of science that I postulated included a mechanism called invisible hand. Though I didn't think it was at all invisible in science, I thought it was visible as hell. In fact, the chapter I discussed it in, I called it the visible hand. I was also aware that invisible hand explanations were somehow had a tarnished reputation in the social sciences, but I didn't realize how tarnished until I read some of the reviews of my book. Miriam Solomon, for example, characterized invisible hand views of science, such as mine, as optimistic fantasies. As a result, not unlikely, I decided I'd better go back and really read up on invisible hands to see if they were as questionable as some of the critics thought. So in this paper, what I'm going to deal with is what are invisible hand explanations and what's wrong with them? I went back and read Adam Smith. To my dismay, in all of his books, he mentions invisible hands three times. We may think it was a major feature of his research. He didn't seem to. In this paper, what I do is present a general analysis of invisible hand explanations based on reading and examples of it, then set out what I take to be the invisible hand that functions in science, and finally show whether or not it fits my analysis. Invisible hand explanations involve the contrast between intended and unintended consequences. Individuals behave the way they do in order to bring about a particular end. But in the process of lots of people doing this, they produce some unintended consequences as well. In the typical case, the intended goal is to benefit the individual, and the unintended consequence has a more general effect. Sometimes these unintended consequences are good, that's the usual examples, but also sometimes they're bad. In Adam Smith's classic example, agents pursuing their own financial good result in the realization of everybody or almost everybody being better off. Conversely, a common example, the tragedy of the commons, none of the people who are herding their cattle intend to destroy the commons. Each of them intend to raise as many cows as they can on the commons. But the net effect is the destruction of the commons. Sometimes, however, invisible hand explanations are defined more narrowly in the more contemporary literature. For example, Friedman assumes this unintended general good must be beneficial for everyone. Now, this seems like a very strong requirement, that if one poor soul doesn't get the benefit of this invisible hand, it isn't an invisible hand. In addition, Murawski complains that the need for invisible hands stems primarily from economists treating actors, economic actors, as if they were Robinson Crusoes, living in total isolation, when actually they form groups and respond as groups. And I don't think that invisible hand explanations require treating, in my case, scientists as hermits. All it's have to be relative autonomy with respect to their individual goals, so that when the groups they form, their primary concern is still looking out after themselves. They're cooperating with other scientists and research groups, but that does not mean that they will always submerge their individual good to the good of the group, that at least sometimes their own individual group will take precedence over the group, good of the group. Because the invisible hand explanations initially in the early formulations turned on the difference between intended and unintended consequences, it seems like these explanations had to be limited to agents that clearly have intentions, i.e. human beings. By the way, I think human beings have intentions. I just don't think they matter very much, unless you're running around with people different from me. Human beings can intend to do one thing and do another. In fact, I think that's the general case. However, some authors have argued for a wider use of intentionality, and Dennett, he wants to take the intentional stance and expand it. And in Darwinian explanations, he and others think that the finely tuning of adaptations can be explained in part in terms of invisible hands explanations. That if you're willing to admit that organisms, including plants, can in some sense strive to reproduce or strive to survive, then those, in quotation marks, intended consequences can have more general results. That is speciation and adaptation. Although this paper deals only with human beings, and in fact only with scientists, I too think the intentional stance can be extended with good effects. In fact, really the point of this paper is to show that it's legitimate for the paradigm area, which makes it then somewhat more liable that people will accept it when they extend it to more interesting paper. The interesting view. Okay. Several authors have noted that invisible hand explanations often result from the difference between appearance and reality, a phenomenon that appears to have been brought about by someone's intentional action was not. It was an unintended consequence of human intention. Conversely, something which appears not to have been brought about by anybody's intention actually was. For example, a few years ago, I will say 10, but at my age it's probably 20, all of the electricity went out on the whole east coast of the United States. And every civil engineer, everybody talked to in power, can't happen, impossible. Well, there was two possible explanations for that. A plot. There was a big plot. The CIA, the KGB, the mafia all got together and out goes the lights of the east coast. Or it was just a series of screw-ups, a whole series of nincompoops screwed up. Now, some people like the conspiracy view of the world. They have a much higher opinion of people than I have. It would take much too much knowledge, forethought, and cooperation to do something like that. So I tend to, whenever we have one of these things that look like they're designed, but you can't imagine how they could have been designed, I think, no, just a series of screw-ups. In any case, Nozick made this distinction, and he called it interesting, hidden hand and invisible hand. I'm going to stick with just the invisible hand explanations today. Now, most of the objections have been raised invisible hand explanations really don't apply specifically to invisible hand explanations. They apply to almost all explanations. Yes. You say invisible hand explanation is not good enough because A, B, C, and D. Well, you look at any kind of explanation, even the simplest causal explanation, and A, B, C, and D don't apply. Are causes sufficient for their conditions and functions necessary? Not close. Does smoking really cause lung cancer? Yes, it really does. Is it sufficient? No. Is it necessary? No. Does it increase the chances by 900%? Yes. But when you see people dealing with causal talk, they introduce really unrealistic standards, and for sure, invisible hand explanations don't meet those standards. But if you have the sort of standards which can apply to even the most unproblematic causal explanations, they apply to invisible hand explanations as well. So much for what my talk is not going to be about and the areas I'm going to avoid and get to it. The real problem with invisible hand explanations is that the conditions necessary for them are too difficult to bring about. They are very, very rare. One of the authors on a and I'm not sure about her name, Almond Margalet, concludes, "The onus of invisible hand explanations lies on the process or mechanism that aggregates the dispersed individual actions into the patterned outcome. It is the degree to which this mechanism is explicit, complex, sophisticated, and indeed a sense unexpected that determines the success and interest of invisible hand explanations." So can the mechanism responsible for scientists behaving the way they do be set out explicitly? Are these mechanisms adequate to bring about the effects I claim they have in science? Or do they merely appeal to some sort of mysterious coincidences that serve only to paper over the fact that we haven't explained this behavior? Those are quotations from people critical of my views. In the remainder of this paper, I set out what I take to be the causal conditions that are responsible for the peculiar epistemic character of science, and argue that these conditions are frequently realized in science, as it has been practiced for the last couple hundred years. I begin with some uncontroversial observations about science and scientists, not about all scientists all the time, but about scientists when they're being most successful. You know, scientists do a lot of things not very well, but every once in a while science will be doing science very well and will be very successful, and those are the periods I'm talking about. As demeaning as it may sound, to a large extent, science is a matter of keeping up with the Joneses, in fact, really surpassing the Joneses. Science sort of dribbled into existence. It just didn't start. It started a couple places in Italy, went under, started a couple places up. Finally, it did catch on and stuck around. And it rapidly became a winner-take-all market, as we'll be hearing about later today. Early on, people involved in science had to find a way to force scientists to make their views public. Now, this might sound crazy to you with the rush to publish that we have in science today, that the big problem was how to get scientists to let other scientists know what they were doing. It was a very secretive activity. You know, several methods were used, which I won't, they're kind of interesting. Anagrams were big initially. Thank God they didn't stick. But the way that stuck was that the first person who published got all the credit. Now, when you first became a scientist or learned about science, probably you were a little dismayed by this. Why should be the, you know, someone gets their paper published 3 days before somebody else, why do they get all the credit and the other person get none? It seems irrational. But it evolved because forced scientists to publish, and it forced them to work hard and fast, which has its negative effects as well. In addition, science turns out to be, like basketball and ballet, a high-resolution activity. Very few seem to make much in the way of contributions. No matter how you measure contributions in science, turns out very few scientists make the most of them. Now, scientists do want credit for their contributions. They want other scientists not only to notice what they've done, but they want them to use it. And the main currency in science is use, not citations. Citations are operational means of kind of getting at possible use. Use is what really matters. And scientists cite the work of other scientists, in part to give credit where credit is due, I suppose, but also it's to lend support for their own ideas. The scientists are caught in a bind. They want their work to be accepted, but they also want it to look original. Now, the more people you cite, you put your new discovery right on a solid bed of past work, the more you do that, the more other scientists are going to take it seriously and possibly adopt it. But then you won't look like your work is very original. Conversely, you can try and make your work look original by citing as few people as possible. But then other scientists are less likely to read it, use it, and even if they do read it and use it, they'd probably be just as generous with their citations of you as you were with them. I don't want to pretend that mutual citation is an infallible guide to importance, credit, etc. in science. It's just an operational criterion. Scientists use operational criteria all the time in their work, and they know if they're none of them are good enough. They just give a rough indication of what they're trying to get at. If scientists can do that, then I think those of us who study science should be allowed to use our rough criteria too. And if anybody has additional suggestions for these operational criteria, I'd be happy to find them. Now, citations, mutual citations, can be found in lots of professions besides science, including philosophy, which is where I am. But if you look at the citation patterns within science and outside of science, you find them to be very, very different. In the first place, in science, almost all of the citations are positive. By that I mean, as so-and-so has so clearly shown. Not to my surprise, I did a citation analysis in a journal in philosophy, the vast majority are negative. Philosophers tend to say, in spite of the fallacious argument presented by X, Y, and Z. In addition, scientists tend to cite their contemporaries, that is, people living at the same time as they are. And the half-life of citations is very short. If you aren't cited within about 4 or 5 years in science, you're never going to be cited. And if you are cited, drop-off becomes very quick, except for a few classic papers. Needless to say, in philosophy, we tend to cite long-dead philosophers. Plato and Aristotle are cited as frequently today as, well, they weren't cited 2,000 years ago, but anyway, they continue to be cited. We even cite some modern philosophers, like Descartes. When I first got into philosophy and discovered Descartes was a modern philosopher, I said, well, what do you call Wittgenstein? Anyway, sometimes philosophers do cite other living philosophers. The trouble is no one has studied it yet to see what sort of patterns arise with this practice. I would like to find out. I'm picking philosophy because I'm a philosopher, but still in lit crit, I would like to see the same sort of attention that's been paid to science and citations apply to various other activities and citations. I think the conventions of science go a good deal deeper than just mutual citation. Although scientists do not test each other's work nearly as much as some naive commentators like Barry Collins think they should, replication does occur in science. In fact, one of the defining characteristics of science is the ability to test claims made by scientists. That shouldn't sound strange in a place like the LSE. Okay. One of the strengths of science is that not only such claims have to be tested, science has, you know, they have to be testable, but you don't have to test all of them. If you had to test every single result before you used it, science would just grind to a halt. One of the virtues of science is that we have theories which organize data into complexes such that if error gets in anywhere, it will have ramifications. Given those ramifications, then you try to go back and find out where how the error got introduced. Now, scientists are also not peculiar in that they're constantly being enjoined to adhere to the canons of their discipline. We all are. We all should teach more, right? We should all spend more time teaching and less time doing research. We hear it, we don't do it, but we hear it. Now, these invocations may have some good effect on people, but they're really, in your own experience, you have to know they're not enough. They're not good enough. For example, physicians in the United States are supposed to conduct only and all those tests necessary to diagnose an illness. But because of our lawsuit laws, every test is run on every patient just to make sure you don't get sued. Another study was done. Physicians can own their own CAT scans, for example. Physicians who own CAT scans, amazingly, their patients need double the number of CAT scans of those physicians who don't own their own CAT scan. Now, I don't mean to say that physicians are especially evil people. It's that just telling people to do good is rarely sufficient for them to do good. Social systems work much better when the good of the individual coincides frequently with the good of the group. Scientists, once again, in this respect, are in a bind. They would like to conduct their research as quickly as possible getting the results out sooner so that they get all the credit in a winner-take-all competition. But the chief credit in science is use. And scientists don't use the work of other scientists idly. In adopting the views of someone else, incorporating them into your own work, you're voting with your careers, and you can't vote any more importantly than that. One of the most important features of use as a criterion of worth is that only practicing scientists can assign it. Non-scientists play big roles in science nowadays, granting agencies, Nobel Prize, things like that. But only scientists can use other scientists' work. To paraphrase a comment by an economist, this was about economic markets, I paraphrased it to be about science. The essence of the invisible hand perspective is that the marketplace of ideas give different scientists who have a common interest in exchanging contributions for credit the opportunity to pursue their common interests with success, not failure. As I mentioned before, scientists rarely test the work of other scientists before they use them. But if things start going wrong, that's when they start testing. They start trying to find out what caused their problems. Now, citations may well give credit where credit is due, but they also leave paper trails for assigning blame. With the possibility of credit goes the possibility of discredit. One effect of uncovering mistakes in the work of other science is to increase the care science will have in using their future work. If you get the reputation of not doing very good work, you are dead. You rush to get your work out too quickly, such that it's not safe for other scientists to use it, and they learn it and won't use it. Scientists are not very good at disproving their own pet hypotheses, but other scientists are happy to do it in their stead. Scientists get very little credit for just replicating somebody else's research. That is, you do it and you get the same results. You can't even get it published. But they do get credit for uncovering mistakes in the work of other scientists. So the rush to publish is constrained in science by the punishment you receive for doing unreliable work. And if you might have noticed that, you know, the two most common things you're supposed to do in science, you're supposed to do really good, solid work, and you're supposed to give credit where credit is due. Yet if you look at the punishments meted out, you are punished fairly severely for producing work that is not accurate, because everyone who uses that work is harmed by it. But if you don't give credit where credit is due, the only person who's hurt is the person who you didn't give credit to. So as you might imagine, the punishments for the two are a good deal asymmetrical. So the message of the preceding 10 minutes is that science is a self-policing system of mutual exploitation, or if you don't like that, cooperation. Same thing in my book. It's also the only self-policing profession that actually polices itself to any significant degree. And that includes the police, college professors, you name it. John Zeman remarks that this system is not just a quaint tribal custom. It is the social mechanism by which reliable scientific knowledge is generated and evolves. Okay, so much for a brief description of what I think, how this invisible hand works in science. Now for some differences of varying degrees of importance. The first difference between Smith's invisible hand and science as a social activity is that frequently scientists claim to have higher goals. And again, I think maybe these beliefs, I think the scientists are truthful. They do have these higher goals. For example, Sir Peter Medawar once remarked, "Scientists on the whole are amiable and well-meaning creatures. There must be very few wicked scientists. There are, however, plenty of wicked philosophers, wicked priests, and wicked politicians." And, and later, in connection with the flap over DNA splicing, "Scientists want to do good, and very often do." I think that this attitude toward science by scientists is very, very helpful, but I don't think it's enough. Why scientists are lucky is the coincidence, the frequent coincidence, between what's good for them as individuals in their career and what's good for science as a whole. You know, because other scientists must use each other's work, and use implies worth, they are forced to give credit, even, you know, implicit credit. And when things occur, they also give discredit, usually explicit, extensive discredit. You know, if scientists, however, were as virtuous as they claim, then you wouldn't have so many priority disputes. Why should it matter who discovered what first? About 10 years ago, again, my dates were, two very good scientists each thought they came up with the molecular structure of the AIDS virus. And we were treated for the next 10 years with these two men going at each other tooth and toenail over who discovered it. Hundreds of thousands of people are dying, and scientists are devoting massive amounts of time to try and see who gets the credit for it. Well, this does make people from the outside look a little askance at science, but moral indignation to one's side. Priority disputes show that scientists can be as venial as everybody else. Also, in understanding scientists, that scientists are much more responsive to local than to global comparisons, as Frank was going to talk about. Scientists do not expect their work to be read by all scientists, to be evaluated by all scientists, to be used by all scientists. Every scientist has his community in mind, the community he wants to impress. But the most important issue is whether the individual goals of these scientists and the good of science or the community he's talking about are sufficiently independent so that they can work across purposes, and I think priority disputes show that they can. As early as 1788, I'm an American, the authors of the Federalist Papers can be found observing that the desire of reward is one of the strongest incentives of human conduct. As a result, the best security for the fidelity of mankind is to make interest coincide with duty. Now, science may well be motivated with calls for knowledge for its own sake, but what's useful is you can be as self-serving as possible and still have the same effect given the social structure of science. You don't have to be a saint to be a good scientist. Better not, because I know a few scientists who are far removed from saint. Because here, in science, with respect to research, virtue and benefit do go hand in hand. Third peculiarity, and I'll try to sign off quickly because I hate people when they go over time. See if I can cut some. Pardon? I have another 20 minutes. Well, we shall start talking real slowly. I somehow read it as half hour, which I think is about right for a paper.
Okay.
I have a story which I frequently tell my students. You will go to meetings and you'll hear over and over again, God, that paper was too long. You will never hear, God, that paper was too short. So try to make it as short as possible, but I'm certainly not going to go an hour. Okay. A third peculiarity of invisible hand mechanism science is that scientists can become aware of them. I did research on scientists, and the whole time I was doing it, I knew when I published my book, my subjects would be able to read it. Now, geneticists don't have to worry about their fruit flies reading their paper, but I had to worry about my fruit flies reading my papers, and I was a little bit uneasy about them. I'm happy to say the results weren't as drastic as I thought they were going to be, but I did take my lashes. Okay. Uncritical scientists, you know, tend to go about their work without thinking of any of the things that I've mentioned in this paper. They just go along pretending like they have solely the altruistic motivations that their dictum say that they have. But if someone were to, the scientist in this audience, were to listen to this paper, might not this self-knowledge change how they behave and make them behave more poorly? It's a common phenomenon. Some predictions, for example, are self-fulfilling, some are self-frustrating. If you get a very respected person in the financial circles to predict that a particular stock is going to go up in a big circulation paper like Wall Street Journal, it's very likely to go up to a large part just because of the prediction. And the same saying the parallel thing happened, self-frustrating predictions, that, that if, let's say you're in a stadium, and over the loudspeaker, someone says, a fault has been found in the girders of the stadium, it's about to collapse, and please walk quickly out of it. Well, you're lucky, may I get everybody out, hence the stadium didn't collapse. So predictions can feed back on their predictor. Might not these invisible hand stories, if enough scientists come to believe them, feed back in a negative way? From my experience, and it's only casual experience, the answer is no. That scientists behave better when they realize what they're doing. When they don't have to feel guilty about when they first get a new book in their field, going to the index to look up their name. None of you have ever done that, right? But when you did it, didn't you feel a little tacky? Yeah. So you've got to do it, and what harm does it do? So that if you realize that, yes, you're in it, you want other scientists to incorporate your ideas into their work, and that you have confidence that they will incorporate it because it looks like it will help them in their work. I can't see why that would bring any great harm to science. Now, all I've said in the preceding may sound plausible or may not, but again, being a good Popperian, how would I decide whether or not it was false? As I was doing my research, I kept writing down things. If my views are correct, this shouldn't happen, or this should happen. And I wanted to test these observations. But testing is very hard. It takes a lot of time. And also testing social phenomena, which these are even harder. But in my book, I made a first stab. I tried to break down the various parts of this theory and test each as independently and separately and localized as possible. Can't tell you much in here. That was the part that my students can really hurt. They read the book, but they skipped over the data. And I was, oh well. People say, okay, this is the way science in the West is organized, and it happens to be organized as being individualistic, putting on the fact that scientists do form research groups, competitive, elitist, all things that used to be bad 10 years ago. I don't know if they're bad now, but at least 10 or 15 years ago, they were really bad. Might it not be work better if it were organized the way Francis Bacon wanted in 1620? It seems strange. One of the first people to write in English on science and how it should be organized wanted to be done on a selfless, cooperative basis. Scientists come together and work together and come up with solutions, and nobody gets any credit for any of the solutions. And it sounds wonderful. So I started doing some history to see how science did occur. And every time scientists, after 1620, after reading Bacon, tried to develop science on a Baconian method, collapsed. For example, the French Academy was formed explicitly on Baconian methods in 1666. But by 1699, they said, this doesn't work. There's just no way that you can keep good people working and everyone getting equal credit for everything that's done. So they switched to the method we know now, that individual people get individual credit. You'd be happy to hear the Royal Society of London started with that method. They didn't have any experimentation with more cooperative methods. So I was trying to find, is there a place where a group of scientists got together to work anonymously, publish their results anonymously, and the results were very, very good? I found one. At least I thought I found an apparent falsifier. Two problems with me. First, it was mathematicians and not empirical scientists. Second, it was all in French. Anyway, I wish During the winter of 1934-35, a group of young French mathematicians decided the textbooks in their period, in the other day, weren't good enough. And what they had to do was a more general textbook. Well, by the time these mathematicians got their first volume done, there were 10 of them. And unlike physicists today, they hated to think of, every time they cited their own work, 10 names. Of course, now in physics, it can be 50 names, but 10 names. So they decided what they'd do is invent a single name for themselves. And there was a famous French general who was notorious for never having won a battle. So they invented a nephew, called him Nicolas Bourbaki. Well, the Bourbaki group kept changing membership. People would come and people would go. And they ended up in 1968 with having published 34 volumes. And they were considered to be, you know, very, very good work. I'm committed that anybody who has the ability goes to look. They will find out that each of those mathematicians published what they did, you know, discoveries they made, the innovations they introduced, separately under their own name. Found one paper by an economist named Murawski, which implies that yes, they did, that everybody knew who did what part. Still, there is something to be said that they would publish consistently under a fictitious name. You know, it's the sort of thing that very smart graduate students like to do. Okay, as I understand invisible hand explanations, they do not require that self-interest is the only motivating factor, it's the only mechanism involved, because you know, there are partially planned economies that do very well. You know, you needn't have planning. From the beginning, conscious effort has played an important role in developing the social structure of science. I mean, it's not, we just didn't let it grow like Topsy. We periodically tried to improve it here, fix this, fix that. And not all of those efforts were detrimental. For example, with improved technology, the result of improved technology was increased delays in publication. As a result, we switched from publication date to submission date as to when you get credit. Back in the 19th century, when you could expect to have a paper out in a week and a book out in 2 months, we now have a paper out in, 6 weeks, 6 months, and a book out in 2 years. Publication date isn't good enough. There's too big of a lag. So we switched it now. It's submission date. So there are ways of working with science, recombining it. Science is now a practice. It's a combination of planned and unplanned, conscious and unconscious design. But I think it's the invisible hand aspect that keeps scientists on the straight and narrow. The patterns I sketch from science are not the result of any mysterious coincidence, nor are they, I think, optimistic fantasy. To the contrary, if anything, I think they sound a little bit cynical. So, what's wrong with invisible hand explanations? Nothing, as long as they're both cogent and true. In fact, such explanations are so meritorious, I only wish we had more of them. Thank you.
That was a truth or not. Do you think that's an important element to your analysis. You know, one of the basic questions, how do you individuate science? Study what obviously is science, you think it's 30 science, back through time, it changes a lot. 150 years ago, God played a big role in science. And nowadays, if you have God in science, you're not going to publish. So certainly lots of things about science has changed through the years. But I was amazed that this particular structure I'm talking about, once it was formed, had a staying power. And it was formed in, I couldn't do the work, but you read Martin Rudwick's book on geology, The Great Devonian Controversy. That's whole point was there was no great Devonian controversy. But anyway, looking areas of science around, I kept finding the same result. Now, how about history? Well, I think and would like history to be a science. But there are people who are in history departments who have very different views about what history is. In the olden days, it was also part literature. It wasn't enough just to have your facts right. You had to write well and write gracefully. I've got nothing against that. I wish that were part of science, the kind of science I'm talking about. Nowadays, however, at least in my history department, we have been taken over by postmodernists. And now chronology doesn't even matter. I was on a promotion and tenure committee for the university, and we were doing this person from history, and several of the referees complained that this person had the chronology wrong. When the department came to defend, there's nothing wrong with chronology being wrong. We're doing textual analysis. And by the way, texts don't constrain interpretation either. And so I kept raising my hand, then how do you decide? Well, I don't think postmodernism is science. Awful lot of what is done in history departments have a role of science, and I would like to see it increased, not decreased. As far as art goes, I have not paid very much attention in this paper at all to the creativity aspect of science. But if you want to find the group that is closest to scientists in this respect, it's artists. When you read about, you know, creative art, and you look like you're reading about the same sort of people. There are big differences. It's very hard to think of what testing would be like in art. Not that I think, I just, you don't test art, I don't know what that would mean. Artists certainly borrow from previous artists. They don't put, you know, references, citations, and what have you, but if you're into the art world, you know who borrowed what from whom, and that's considered really, you know, an honor, not something to be against.
I've just broken the rule myself. I'm under strict instructions to ask speakers to give their name and affiliation. I realise I haven't given you my name either, so I should never retrospect it. I'm Alan Grafton, and I'm from the St. John's College, Oxford. And I'd like to ask the next speaker to follow my good and recent example.
I'm Gary Ransom from Trinity College, Cambridge. I'm a sociologist, but the kind who likes the kind of thing you say, not the other.
Okay.
You began by reminding us that it's the last 200 years that science has really taken off. Now, if you talked to the people at the forefront of European intellectual life then and told them, you won't believe the progress that's going to be made in the physical sciences. That would have surprised them, because a lot of them would have said, and some of them did, that the real progress will be made in the human sciences, because it's easier. Now, why were they wrong?
Because it isn't easier, it's harder. Well, but why did they think it was going to be easier? Because we seem to know so much about ourselves, that everybody knows so much about ourselves. And almost nobody knew anything about the planets. Unfortunately, the knowledge that we seem to know about ourselves is not very useful in making a science of us.
Why not?
Well, I think because we evolved to be medium-sized organisms with a certain range of ability to visualize, and we're prone not to have to accept technical terms. We don't want to be subdivided into units that differ markedly from our common sense units, and then have our behavior explained in terms of these technical units. But this is not my field.
Number two is
I'm John Zeeman.
Yes. Did I say Zeeman?
And that's the
excited. Thank you very much.
You're an engineer.
I'll send for you any time. In fact, I have you down in my list of works to be cited favorably. what you say about the sciences of 150 years ago and not much change and so on, yes, indeed, fine. And indeed, it's a sort of commonplace of some history of science that academic science of that kind was invented in the beginning of the 19th century, and this is the social structure which we are doing. But are we living in that time now? Okay, as a philosopher, it may not be so difficult for you, but for the natural scientists around us, and those of us who are or have been natural scientists at various times, will be very concerned about the changes in the social structure of science, things like teamwork, things like intellectual property rights, accountability of research, a whole lot of factors which are changing the terms of this arrangement. Do you think the visible, invisible hand will be working towards the same beneficial goals in that new social structure which we are now living in? That seems to be the real question that comes out of this type of discourse.
I'm terrified it won't. As more and more non-scientists get to have a bigger hand in what is done in science, allocating the money, deciding which issue should be studied, which should not be studied, I'm afraid the invisible hand is little by little going to stop working and science will not be what it was.
Why non-scientists? Why not the scientists themselves doing their best, intending well for the future of science in all sorts of ways? Might this not be an unintended consequence of the changes of structure that they are involved in, and indeed very often, actually positively welcoming? It might be, for example, the big science activities at CERN, etc. These may well be things that are damaging to the science structure, even though they're precisely the things that the great scientists of our time are
well, I don't.
This is the sort of problem. Yeah,
I don't know much about CERN, but I do know something about the Human Genome Project. And in the early years, I could not find a biologist who thought that this was good use of people's money. But there were some who thought physicists get big money, hence biologists should get big money. And the only project they could think of that they could sucker Congress into funding was the Human Genome Project. Several years before, someone had tried Flora North America. No, Flora North America didn't get off. But the Human Genome Project did. And most biologists, why they didn't like it was it was going to be big bucks and it was not going to be new money. It was going to be taken from their budgets. So there are all sorts of smaller investigations which are much more likely to be relevant, much more likely to have important implications, were going to be cut to pay for this Human Genome Project. That's exactly what's happened. We have this amazing amount of pedestrian science. We have sequencing slaves chained to lab tables doing work, and once it's over, they will have no jobs. They can't do anything else but sequence, and we don't need that many sequencers.
John,
yes.
May I ask you a question? I want really to sort of emphasize a point that you made, but it went past so quickly in the sense that one might want this. Of course, it's true. There's no point in my publishing the paper and everybody using it. I mean, at first sight, that's clear. But if it turns out that when they use it, it doesn't work, then I'm not doing myself any good. And part of the whole argument of the invisible hand argument has to be that things don't work if they're wrong.
No.
Now, you know, I remember reading your book some years ago, feeling worried that most of the things you said worked out as well for theology. And yet I don't think theology has made any progress in the last 10,000 years. I think science does. And the essential difference is if you hold a false theology, it's more likely to do you good.
I'm not even sure what a false versus true theological belief is. But the part it is so commonplace, I was embarrassed for being to emphasize it. There's something in science called testing. Now, you know, in science, you can test more easily and more directly than you can anywhere else in human activity. In fact, probably, there's some activity that in the past wasn't considered science, but a method of testing arose in it, we would gobble up and it would become science. So the testing part I did mention, and there was one chapter on it, but probably since there was nothing new in that chapter, it didn't register. Most of my emphasis was on the social structure, because that was what most people, most scientists, gave me static about. There's no social structure to science. We work in, you know, we're just disembodied intellects, and, you know, we're truth for its own sake, and giving credit where credit is due, and all this sort of thing, and then I kind of look quizzical, and they give me a little wink, and I give them a little... No, it was the social part that I found most interesting, readers found most interesting. So I didn't talk a whole lot about testing, but testing is absolutely necessary.
And if I was back, former professor of mathematics at the school, professor at the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Here's a thing that you may find interesting. We have here two professors of mathematics. Neither of us have any idea of the apportionment of credit within Bourbaki, and I personally know of no mathematician who has bothered to investigate that or has any idea of who wrote what and who's responsible for that.
Yeah. Other people don't care, that's for sure. My point is, did they care? And in this paper by Murawski, it wasn't written for this purpose, but he kept pointing to a particular person in the group, published this here, published that there, so that the people in the group wanted to make sure they got credit for what they were doing, not giving to this amorphous group. Well, how many people who published way back then do you cite today?
A lot.
Is math kind of like philosophy, where we go all the way back to Socrates and Plato, or?
No, we'll go all the way back to Newton and Descartes.
Okay.
You cite Bourbaki.
I did begin by saying, you know, this one counterexample I don't like, partly because it's a friend, partly it's math and not empirical science. I don't know how weird mathematicians are. I'm sure you're weird, I just don't know which way.
Yeah, Frank Allen,
Cambridge, yeah. You know, it seems to me that the different habits has two parts to it. One is a metaphor for self-organizing system. And the second is the judgment whether that self-organization is good, the outcome. Now you seem to conflate this. Now, economists very carefully, poetry, since they argue, that quite often this sort of self-organization, they turn out very bad indeed. Painting places, all sorts of theory games of poetry, you know, which I don't have to cite the business in other ways. So that we have a, you know, I call them a gap in your exposition. I understand that there is the invisible hand in the sense of motives. I also agree that it obviously leads to organization. But is it good? I mean, for instance, are people too narrow? Can they become very orthodox without looking outside? All that stuff. Are they afraid of deviation from orthodoxy?
I began early on contrasting those situations that had good effects versus bad. And the bad I used was the tragedy of the commons, whereas each individual farmer, but then I switched and mentioned that the literature seems to concentrate on which seems much more implausible, that is, good effects happening. I mean, we're all used to bad things happening when we don't intend to. I mean, my whole life is filled with when anything bad happens to me, the person says, oh, I didn't mean to. And that's easy, because their intentions matter not at all. Now, so of course they didn't mean to. What's unusual is when all these people who are doing one thing do something else, and it turns out to be a good thing. So that's why I concentrated on it. I'm sure I could write three times the paper on invisible hands giving rise to bad things.
In science?
In science, yes.
Gerard Fatler is my name. Just first a comment on what we've just been talking about. Daly has the term invisible foot to describe those things for the fact. What I would like to do there is to ask you whether you think science automatically gets right. Not what is correct and accurate and well done experimentation, but does it get right the questions that are important? Scientists agree that certain things are important, but how do they agree that and how do they test that? That does seem to me part of the social structure and not entirely covered by your discussion about refutation.
It isn't covered at all. Some scientists seem to have noses for not just important problems, they usually are well understood which ones are important, but important ones which finally can be solved. In the history of biology, time and time again, a great scientist as a young man was told, embryology is where it's at. The next big discoveries are going to be embryology. Bateson, for example. Time again, they went against the recommendations of their professors and became famous. Now, right now, the claim is embryology is hot. Embryology is where it's at. Finally, we're going to make headway in embryology. It would be nice. But there are important, everybody knows embryology is important. What's wrong with the Human Genome Project? It's once we get all those GCAs, Ts, etc., we've got to go from there to something. And we can't do that yet very well. So once we have this huge book that nobody will want to read, no one will be able to do anything with, we're waiting for embryology to take hold. So you're right, my mechanism has nothing to do with what are the important questions, or more importantly, what it is about certain scientists who allow them to go from important question to important question that can be solved right now to important question that can be solved.
The question also suggests a way back to postmodernism, because if scientists negotiate among themselves about what questions are of importance, then it may be that science is not simply the discovery of objective, but part of the process of deciding what kinds of things are to be included.
You know, what's wrong with postmodernism is not that they're all wrong, it's that there are certain parts which are right. There are a lot of negotiation goes on in science. It's just we scientists don't negotiate facts. That is, let's all get together and agree the world's flat. I mean, psychologists did get together and voted that gay people weren't abnormal. Now, I happen to think gay people aren't abnormal, but that's not how you do it in science. I mean, they meant well, but...
I'm not in a position to defend postmodernism myself, but I can fly to someone else with it.
Celia Hayes, UCL. What kind of generalizations do you think can be made about the conditions in which an invisible hand explanation works? So, for example, would you want to say that the operation of a selection process is a necessary condition for the applicability of an invisible hand?
Could you hear at the back?
It was a connection between invisible hand explanations and selection processes. When I began by saying I'm going to do the paradigm case of invisible hands, that is, intentional agents, human beings, fits and starts, when all else loses, you know, fails, are intentional, behave intentionally. Try to get it clear there. My goal, of course, is to expand invisible hand explanations to evolutionary biology, that natural selection is a mechanism very akin to invisible hand explanations. And now what was your question?
Would you go so far as to say that the operation of the selection process is a necessary condition for a positive invisible hand effect?
God, I've always thought of it the other way, and I have to redo and think it this way. My answer is I can't answer that without sitting down with paper and pencil and thinking about it. The other direction I'm committed to, yes.
The original Adam Smith invisible hand in economics had no selection process, did it? That was individuals following their own economic interests resulting in what's beneficial distribution of goods.
Somewhere fast.
Yeah. True, some businessmen went fast, that's true. So selection is sort of one half of it.
The point I want to make, one effect of my mechanism is that scientists usually succeed, there's something wrong.
because scientists almost always fail. Now, it looks very successful because scientists publish their successes. All their failures never get published. Then of those that get published, only a tiny percent ever have any effect. In point of fact, science is an incredibly inefficient activity. Apparently, I think, though, it follows that if it's a creative activity, it's got to be inefficient. There's no way to have efficient creativity. Can you imagine someone arguing, we must make painting more efficient. Our artists are not producing a high enough percentage of really beautiful paintings. Well, it makes some sense, say science, we've got to organize science, so science come out with true explanations more frequently. I think if you make science too efficient, it will just cease. A nice thing about selection processes is they turn on inefficiency.
Robert Neal, retired economist from Cambridge. I understand your argument, your premises. They are that scientists are ambitious, pretending to do good. They're constrained by publication and by that experimentation, testing the fact that their results can always be falsified. I wonder if the importance of those premises is perhaps, not perhaps be sort of amplified, shown up by considering the deviant part of science, which has been very important in recent years, namely the absorption of scientists into military activities, where, let's say, people have the highest moral motivation in winning the Cold War is fine, there's no doubt economical wars. But the things that have been absent were partly publication, a lot of work to do. Not at all. And secondly, probably much more important, that the results of your work were virtually never proven, because by and large weapons weren't used so long as it was a Cold War, and even if you do have a war, the outcome of the war is the most frightful between the confidence and incompetence of general soldiers and the weapons you pursued, and hence the test of verification by experiment is really absent. So again, I think about an extraordinary area of science into which people went, for perhaps good motives, which was not subject to the constraints we have with a normal open history of science.
Yeah, there's two areas of science
which
mystify
me. Are the tests of publication and verification.
Mine deals with only academic science, not military science, not science in industry. Military science had no access to any of the data, obviously. How am I going to... I did give a talk at Los Alamos, a talk like this, and got very different responses from the audience. And to some extent, it was because they feel left out. They've done all this work and nobody ever going to know about it. They feel cheated. I have given talks like this and interviewed people working for industry. And there's very strange things, you know, that they always talk about the suits. That means scientists don't wear suits, but the businessmen wear suits. And the suits will tell you, you've got to do this within 6 months or give it up. And he had to decide, no fat cheese that didn't taste like erasers. And he had 6 months to do it. And he didn't do it. That science works, to some extent, it must have worked in the military, and to some extent, how it worked in industry. I did interview the president of Bell Lab, and they have had a system very much like academic science. It's a mystery. I mean, I don't know what to say, but you know, now that we can patent genes, there's real dangers in science. Sometime in the near future, I'm going to Cold Spring Harbor, and it's bringing a bunch of judges together to have scientists and one philosopher talk to them about what makes science go, because increasingly lawsuits are being heard, and the judges don't know at all about what science is like. And so it's trying to educate judges so that when these lawsuits over, you stole my gene,
start hitting the courts, that they'll be able to educate them better, adjudicate them better. But yeah, there's areas which people are afraid of that are going to ruin science. I think the intrusion of money, I mean, scientists right now, very few can make money, even if they wanted to. Most don't want to. They don't mind getting a salary, but the money they're after is the money for the research. But as you get more and more scientists be able to make big money, I think you're going to see the ethos of science decline.
Richard Webb from LSE. I'd like to continue a little bit on this industrial science side. Given that probably more people with a science training are involved in something like industrial government or military science, and given that the impact of what they have done, both beneficial and harmful, is much greater in everyday lives than that of academic science, I'm a little bothered that you don't want to talk about them, that you have put a fence around your topic of academic science.
I have this peculiar tendency not to talk about something I don't know anything about, though that's apparently rare for a philosopher. The other is having access to your data. If you can't have access, I mean, I couldn't even have done the research I did unless it just so happened I was intimately connected with a group of scientists. I was working with them, and I could see them on a day-to-day basis. I was honest enough to tell them, in addition to everything else, I'm studying you because I'm going to write a book about you. But they forgot about that right away. And so I spent 15 years working with these scientists and got the sort of data I needed to test my views. I thought that was a lot. Now I'm supposed to worm my way into Los Alamos? If anybody could.
I do think there has been work done. I do think there is quite a lot available, but not necessarily published, on the social structures of industrial science. And I think you'll find that they operate according to rules that are similar but different to the academic science ones.
I'd be happy if it was someone who was 30 or 40 years old, got busy, and started working on that.
It may also be the case that you can view those parts of science as sort of stemming from academic science, just self-perpetuating. So the culture ethos of science is determined by academic science because it creates its own new members. So you might expect to find them to be derivative of the academic community.
That scientists are all trained in the academic area, get the academic ethos, carry it with them when they go into...
And they would be sort of dead end.
But they don't produce more.
Can I have one more question in the academic?
I think you're supposed to give your name to remind people.
Why?
You're supposed to give your name to remind.
I'm sorry.
One's enough? Okay. You recognize the...
Okay. I'm a sociologist. You seem to imply that once the thing is up and running and efficient, like early 19th, 20th century sciences, that when people do make mistakes, they are recognized in the community pretty quickly, and you can tell what success and failure is. But it surprises me, and I'm now talking from the outside of this particular discipline, it's many years ago since John Searle, the philosopher, said to me, you have got to read the most amazing review you'll ever read in your life in the Journal Language from 1959, which was, of course, Chomsky's review of Skinner's verbal behavior. Now, 20 years later, I would meet Skinnerian psychologists, hardline behaviorists, who were totally unmoved. Now, that's not the picture that you were painting, but how the scientific community corrects itself and discards the paper.
What can I say? There are people who will, you know, were raised, say, behaviorists, and wall them off inside a community, not read anything that appears in any journal save their own journals. This is a very bad strategy in any area, including science. And also, in those cases, there were arguments that you had to contrast. And one thing about arguments, no, there's no such thing as knock-down, drag-out argument. Nothing's conclusive. Philosophers are smart enough, they can twist any argument and get around anything. What I would like is data. Now, again, totally out of my area, but I was told that Freudian's complaints against behaviorists were that if you just condition someone, let's say someone picked their nose all the time, and you condition them not to pick their nose. without going in and fixing up whatever was wrong with their psyche that led them to pick their nose, that there would be symptom replacement. They'd start picking their ear or something else. Apparently that didn't happen. That doesn't happen. As far as I could tell, the Freudians didn't care. Now, the right response is not, okay, we give up Freudianism. The response of a parent falsifier is you've got to try and find out what's wrong with your theory, which entails there should be symptom replacement when in point of fact there isn't symptom replacement. Just ignoring it is not being a scientist. So if, you know, if there is, in Chomsky, knock-down, drag-out arguments and preferably data in opposition to the behaviorists and they just ignored it, they're not being scientists. They'll pay the price. They have paid the price. Okay. They have paid the price.
I want to ask a second question too, may I ask you? But it's really a comment, going back to the question of the last there, which I think is basically what Einstein agreed with, which is, are scientists actually good at picking the right questions rather than are they good at measuring the right answer? And you said quite rightly, I think, that the hand of the problem isn't too good. And certainly the invisible hand doesn't help them. And I really like your example of development biology, because I know some sense since 1950 that embryology had to be an important problem in biology. It just so happened it was an insoluble one, so it began to be the world. And really suddenly, for other reasons that have not easy to do that in the last 5 to 10 years, suddenly I think breakthroughs really are being met. For me, it's the area of biology that I'd love to be in, but I'm a bit too old to be interested. But I don't think it, and I don't really know whether you agree with it, the fact that we're not good at spotting the soluble question doesn't actually affect your argument about the success of the invisible hand, because, okay, most of us, as you pointed out, are working on the wrong question. But we don't solve it. So we don't get credit, we don't become famous. An awful, and inevitably, creativity is a very efficient procedure. And provided that, so to speak, one knows when a scientist has identified the question, I got the answers to it. The thing is, the mechanism you describe is going to work. So the fact that we're bad at identifying the question shouldn't actually affect your argument. Now, I'm really asking, is that right?
That's right, and it has also implications. Some people thought, you look, the vast majority of scientists don't do very much, so we should make them redundant. Well, first off, it's hard to know in advance who's going to be productive. But I also think that there require selection processes require large numbers. Even if we could tell who were going to be, quote, the productive scientists, if you eliminated a lot of the non-productive ones, probably the productive ones would stop being productive. Reminds me of date farmers in the early years. Half of their trees didn't produce dates. So they started cutting down all the trees that didn't produce dates until they cut down the last male tree, and then all the other trees stopped producing dates. So I think there's a good argument for we have to have quite a few scientists if you want any progress at all. Tea time?
Well, David, I have some presents for you, which is a handy tradition at Darwin Seminars. It's a book called Bright Paradise by Peter Rady, the Gibson publisher. A book by Steve Jones called In the Blood, God, Genes and Destiny. Small work, which is signed by the author. And finally, The Winner Take All Society, which you'll hear about after tea, signed by its author, Robert Frank. The tea, you're all welcome to tea, which I think is through this door.
The steward there to show the way.
The will, yes, good. A livery steward will show the way to tea, and we should reassemble at 5 o'clock to hear Robert Frank give the next talk. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the second half of our meeting today. I'll apologise to those of you who went to tea for bringing you back 2 minutes too early. but I hadn't realised we were all going to be so agreeable. I began this early. I'd like to discuss another aspect of Charles Darwin as a family man to begin the second half of the talk, of the meeting, and it's connected with chloroform and childbirth. Darwin was very keen on administering chloroform to his wife while she was giving birth in order to alleviate pain. And he had to do it himself because doctors of the day wouldn't do it for him. And they wouldn't do it because they believed that pain in childbirth was natural and that it was right that the woman should suffer in this way and she might not form a proper relationship with the child if that was so. And Darwin corresponds with T.H. Huxley about this, as you read in his correspondence. And Darwin refers to blessed chloroform and how terrible childbirth is and how wonderful that he's able to alleviate the pain. But I was wondering why doctors believed that then and whether there were any parallels now to those kinds of beliefs. And I think that it's part of the sort of glorification of motherhood that went on in the 19th century, which was to do with the fact having a non-working wife as an ornament was an important status symbol. And it was important to make it seem as though motherhood was magical and special. And I suspect that that's still with us. It's still true that we still like to think that mothers have a special part in children's lives rather than fathers. And this is a justification for holding women in a particular kind of relationship to men within couples and in society generally. So I like to think that if Darwin were alive today, the social structures he would be rebelling against would be to do with childcare rather than the relief of pain in childbirth. I also wondered why it was that Darwin was like that. And it seemed that Darwin himself did not work for a living. His research was funded basically by his father's generosity. So in a sense, Darwin was female-like in the way that he was funded. And so I wondered whether Darwin's personal situation allowed him to have greater sympathy with the women of the day. So I don't know whether there is a feminist strand to Darwinian studies, but if there isn't, I think there ought to be one. Which brings me to the second talk this afternoon. Robert Frank is a very distinguished economist who has the added distinction of writing on topics of great interest to biologists with titles such as Morality and Adaptive Rationality. And if Homo economicus could choose his own utility function, presumably that means or her own utility function, would he want one with a conscience? Well, that's quite a radical question about whether or not biology underlies economics. And also passions within reason. Again, trying to explain reason to do with emotions. So I'm very much looking forward to listening to Robert's talk. He's the Goldwyn Smith Professor of Economics, Ethics, and Public Policy, Cornell, so he covers quite a wide span. And his title is Economic Justice in a Winner-Take-All Society.
Thank you very much, Alan. I wonder if you would have titled that paper, if Homo economicus could choose his or her utility function, would he or she want one with a conscience? I hope you.
Her or his, she or he.
To each our own. I was uncomfortable agreeing to speak on the subject that I'm speaking on today in the Darwin seminar, since it's not really a Darwinian subject proper. Helena Cronin, all those of you who know her, won't be surprised. Immediately she was gracious and reassured me, it won't matter, you know, I'm sure it'll be interesting, people will be delighted to hear. I did, however, spend some time trying to forge in my own mind at least some links between Darwin's thinking and the basic ideas that I want to describe to you, which come from the book that Philip Cook and I wrote and was published in the U.S. last September, The Winner Take All Society. The book's about how the markets we've seen in sports and entertainment, markets where a handful of performers at the top of each arena capture the lion's share of the economic rewards, how that reward structure now has migrated widely elsewhere in the economy, and what the causes of it are and what some of the consequences of it have been. But I want to start, just because of the occasion, with a Darwinian analogy to the phenomenon that I'm going to talk about. And I was surprised at how very exact the particulars of the analogy seemed. I want to talk about the competition among males in sexually reproducing species for access to the reproductive capacity of females. The interesting issues that arise come up because of a simple asymmetry. Whereas the female in the species invests heavily in the gestation and care of the offspring, and larger and more costly egg cell, the male contributes in many cases often just a small dose of very cheaply manufactured semen. And so as a matter of principle, it would be possible for one male, or at least a small number of males, to sire almost all the offspring in the population. And indeed, in some populations, a very small number of males do sire virtually all the offspring in the population. There's been one species of seal studied, for example, where 4% of the breeding age males were found to have sired some 88% of all the surviving offspring. Now, I cite this case because it's an example of a winner-take-all tournament with enormously high stakes for the contestants involved. If you're not in that inner circle that gets to breed, you're essentially at a dead end, evolutionarily speaking. So when we think about the steps humans take to position themselves for a better shot at the prizes that occur in economic markets, I think the stakes in these more direct contests over reproductive access are just enormously more immediate and vivid. Well, there are two interesting consequences that come from this asymmetry between male and female reproductive strategies, and they both involve forms of waste when viewed from the perspective of the group as a whole, and each of them shows up in a nice parallel in the market structures I'm going to talk about. The first one is that we get too many males in sexually reproducing species. Since, after all, a small number of males could sire the whole of the offspring of the species, it would seem that from the species point of view, the logical thing to do, if nature thought that way, which of course it does not, the logical thing to do would be to assure a supply of diverse and particularly able males and assign them the task of fathering all the offspring and just be done with the 98% of the rest of the males who merely fight and eat and get in the way. Conserve those resources for more directly productive pursuits. R.A. Fisher recognized that that's not what John Maynard Smith taught us was an evolutionarily stable strategy. If there's a population that has primarily females in it, which might be just the population that a benevolent dictator for the species might prescribe, that's not a population that is stable from invasion. If we think of a population that has one male for every two females, and you're a parent and could manipulate the sex of your offspring, and if your goal were to propagate as many copies of the genes you carry into your grandchildren's generation, it's quite clear on a moment's reflection that your best strategy would be to have male offspring. The limiting factor in the reproductive capacity of the next generation is the number of children that can be born and reared given the female capacity in the system. And if we just imagine that a female's capacity in some species is 4 children per breeding female, then if you're a parent and you have a male offspring, that male will, on the average, it could be a winner-take-all situation where a few males get all, but the expectation, on the average, any son you'd have in such a population would, if he competes on equal footing with the other males, expect to have 2 mates and therefore give rise to 8 grandchildren. Having a daughter in that same population gives rise to 4 grandchildren for you. So if you find yourself in a population in which males are in the minority, and there are any genes out there that govern the proportion of sex of offspring one way or another, genes that favor the production of male offspring in such populations will tend to proliferate widely, and this is, R.A. Fisher recognized, was why in most sexually reproducing species we have half males. Grossly inefficient, albeit that's the equilibrium we get. Any other equilibrium is unstable. So there's an overcrowding effect. That's one of the forms of waste. A second form of waste has to do with particular design details in the male phenotype, especially in polygynous mating systems where the winner-take-all aspect of this phenomenon is most pronounced. We see very pronounced adaptations in the male phenotype of characteristics, behaviors, other features in the phenotype whose express purpose seems to be to enable individual males to do damage to other males of the species, thereby better to get access to the reproductive capacity of females. So, for example, in the elk, the male elk has a huge rack of antlers that extend over 12, 13, 14 feet. These antlers are wonderfully adaptive when it comes to intimidating other males, actually for doing battle with other males if the need arises over access to females, but they're woefully maladaptive from the perspective of being able to flee from predators. If an elk gets chased into the woods by a pack of dogs, he's really stuck with this big, literally stuck with this big rack of antlers because there are many places he just can't get through with the antlers that wide. So it would be better, clearly, for all elks if every elk out there had a rack, let's say, a third as wide as the existing racks. But that, Maynard Smith would immediately object, wouldn't be an evolutionarily stable strategy. Any mutant male with slightly longer antlers would do better in the contest for reproductive access to females. That benefit would outweigh the few occasions when he would be more rapidly trapped by a predator. And so we see that the elks end up with that second form of waste, this prodigiously wide rack of antlers that's so useful from the individual's point of view, so maladaptive from the perspective of the larger unit, the species. That was one of Darwin's main themes, in fact, that selection takes place at lower levels rather than at higher levels, generally speaking. There's lots of interesting work going on now, I understand, about precisely what level, how far down does it go. Some interesting examples of conflicts between the interests of genes within individuals are starting to surface with interesting stories attached to them. But in the simple story, the conflict is between the individual and the group, and that's really going to be one of the themes of the story that I'll tell for human societies. Now, the stylized fact that we begin with is that the distribution of economic reward in society has become enormously more disparate in the last decades. I'll show you a snapshot of a brief period in the U.S. I've come to learn that the growth at the top in Britain has also been sharp in recent decades, although perhaps not as sharp in the U.S. as in the U.S. This chart shows that between the years 77 and 89, the top 1% of the income distribution had about 107% growth in earnings. People in the middle, their earnings grew a little, but their wage actually fell a little bit in real terms. The slight earnings growth that shows up in the chart here is a reflection of the fact that women were working longer hours, and therefore the earnings actually grew a little bit. But wage rates fell in real terms. And at the bottom, there's been actually quite substantial loss of ground in real terms among wage earners. And so that's the basic picture. It was recently reported that in the last 25 years in the U.S. among males, 70% of all earnings growth had gone to the top 1% of earners. So it's really become quite dramatically more unequal in terms of reward in the economic system. And there have been a number of attempts to explain this. The standard economic explanation turns first to the so-called human capital model. A person's wage depends on her human capital. She may have a lot of training, experience, intelligence, energy, ambition,
social skills, all these things that might affect a person's productivity, we amalgamate into this collection of stuff that we call human capital, and then if you have a lot of it, you earn a higher wage than if you have little of it. It's analogous to physical capital in the sense that somebody who has 10,000 pounds in the bank will earn twice as much interest as somebody with 5,000 pounds in the bank. So if wages change, we look first to discover if there's been some underlying change in the factors that govern productivity, which in the economist's view are what govern ultimate wages that people get paid. And that turns out to be a disappointing exercise. The distribution of human capital hasn't changed much in any measurable way over the last 25 years. People aren't smarter now, more energetic, better trained. They're a little bigger. In the United States, people have grown a little bit during that period, but that's not relevant in any obvious way to productivity in most occupations. It's a dead end, apparently, looking at that. There's some purchase to be had by looking at the return to certain kinds of human capital. So if we look at people with college degrees, the economic rate of return on having that degree is a little higher now than it used to be. But even so, within any category we can measure, so if we looked at a sample that consisted only of people with college degrees, we would see that the inequality of earnings within that sample has grown by just about the same amount as the inequality of earnings population-wide. It's a very unusual increase in inequality in that one sense, whereas in the past, run-ups in inequality typically have been the result of the skilled pulling away from the less skilled, and there's a little bit of that going on here. Now, we see within every skill category, those at the top pulling away from those in the middle and at the bottom. The field you're in makes a difference as to what you earn, obviously. The things that were in demand 30 years ago, many of them are not in demand today. Other things that weren't a good subject to know before are English majors and people in the humanities are thought to have gotten a raw deal in the current labor market. It's true, if you track the earnings of English lit majors, they don't do nearly as well as people who are software designers. No question about that. But again, if you look at people in the humanities, people who teach or work in some way with English lit, the distribution of their earnings has become more skewed, just as in the other cells. So it's not that. People have talked about foreign competition as the source of this increasing disparity of earnings, and I think it's true that increased pressure from competition in manufactured goods from abroad, or at least the potential for that, has held wages down at the very low end of the economic totem pole. The unions aren't bargaining as tough now, in the knowledge that if they bargain too tough, the employer will simply relocate to a low-wage country. That argument doesn't seem to hold for other occupations in the labor market. Dentists. Cook and I looked at detailed data regarding the earnings of dentists and found that the number of high earners among dentists had roughly doubled between the last two census periods, a time when the average earnings of dentists hadn't grown significantly at all. And it doesn't seem to be the case that there's any influence of competition from dentists from other countries to speak of in that market. So that's likely not the answer. There does seem to be competition from abroad in other high-wage labor markets. The software engineers in Bombay do compete with software engineers in London and Seattle. But in that sector, the salaries of software people have kept pace and then some in both England and the United States. So none of that seems to really get us purchase. And so Cook and I have offered an alternative hypothesis to explain in particular why salaries have grown so sharply at the top. And it's this claim, once again, that there has been a spread of what we call winner-take-all markets. These are markets, as I said, where a few top people capture most of the gain. More formally, they're markets where small differences in performance translate often into enormous differences in reward. If you think about the music industry, in 1900, I heard on our National Public Radio feature show a few months ago a report on the music industry in the state of Iowa, and they announced that there had at that time been 1,500 opera houses in the state of Iowa. Iowa is not a very populous state. It was less populous then. This struck me at the time as a staggering number of opera houses. I discovered that what they meant was live music halls, but in any event, the point seemed roughly the same. Music was consumed almost exclusively in live performance, and if you wanted to listen to a soprano, sure, even in 1900 you'd have been delighted to hear the best soprano, but the best soprano simply couldn't serve all the people who wanted to hear the best soprano, and so there was a market for the second best soprano. The 100th best soprano, indeed the 500th best soprano, earned an adequate living performing in one of those tens of thousands of concert halls around the world where people went to consume music. Now, of course, most of the music is produced by mechanical means. We stick the compact disc into the box, and out comes this breathtakingly lifelike recreation of what the sound was that we would have heard in the concert hall. Perhaps it even sounds better than the sound that we would have heard in the concert hall. And then to the extent that we reach agreement on who sings the Mozart arias more pleasingly than any other. And there's obviously room for discussion amongst the critics, but slowly Kathleen Battle seemed to emerge as the one who seemed to capture the most favor. And I see one gentleman vigorously shaking his head, so that's the beauty of it. You know, we don't have to have a single winner necessarily, but Kathleen Battle has been, in fact, the winner in this arena, and we can all listen to her compact disc, and perhaps we're each willing to pay a cent or two more to listen to her rather than some other soprano, but that's enough, since there are so many of us, to put her, economically speaking, in the driver's seat. She can name her salary, basically. If the record company that wants to sign her doesn't offer a seven-figure salary, then there's some other one that will gladly do it, because each knows that there are millions of discs to be sold, and if she's on the label, that's the one that gets the sale. Now, you, sir, I should have said that these are the those near the top get a disproportionate share markets. There's not literally one winner in almost any of these markets. There's a plurality, but the point's the same, that success depends on relative performance. There can be small differences in absolute performance, and those can translate in this arena into huge differences in final reward. So what Cook and I are saying is that the change that's taken place has been one that's been driven by technology and other factors. I mean, I've got a long laundry list. In one of the chapters of the book, we look at 14 or 15 factors that give rise to this phenomenon. There are falling transportation costs. The fact is that the value of goods now is much greater per pound of good, you know, a good that can cost $1,000, and all that money is in the software in the good, and the software is light. You can ship it anywhere. It doesn't. If somebody's got the best software program, there's no reason that product can't take on the whole market. So if we look at the market for tax advice, we can see how the technology has transformed that market slowly over the years. People almost always went to their local accountant. This was a quintessentially local practitioner industry. You'd get advice about your tax, you'd pay the accountant's fee, it was the wage times the number of hours he'd spent working on your case, and perhaps some accountants got a slightly higher wage because they dealt with more important tax files than others, but the distribution of income was fairly flat in that occupation. Then came the tax franchisers. I don't know what the history of them in England was, but in the United States there was a revolution in the industries. H&R Block was the company that introduced it stateside. They discovered that you could use part-time non-professionals to do a great deal of the work that went into preparing tax, and they, as a result, captured an enormous share of the business that had formerly gone to single practitioner accountants. The distribution of earnings became much more concentrated in that market. The shareholders and the innovators in H&R Block walked away with rewards that had in the past been going to solo practitioner accountants, and now the last step, or the next step, has been tax software for the masses. The computer tax software programs began appearing about 10 years ago, and there was a big battle in the magazines. The critics evaluated them, and they tested them for accuracy, for comprehensiveness, for user-friendliness, and then gradually consensus emerged on which one was best, which ones were best, and those drove out all others, so that even if the Mac and Tax, TurboTax, the two versions of the Intuit program that have swept the market in the U.S., even if those were only a hair's breadth better than their closest competitors, why use second best when you could stamp out the disc just as cheaply from the best program as from the second best program? So the reward concentration has proceeded apace on account of that. I'll show you an interesting case study of how it's worked in the publishing industry, that some of the forces are clearly visible in that industry. One of the big changes has been that we've moved from selling books through independent booksellers to national chains of booksellers. I understand that the book industry has recently been deregulated in the UK, so I think many of the changes I'll describe here you can look for to occur in England in the coming months if they haven't already begun to surface. The independent booksellers would typically have an independent view of what their readership might be interested in. You'll walk by the storefront windows of a local bookstore and see hundreds of different titles scattered about in an irregular array, titles often you've never heard of, by people you've never heard of. They think they're interesting. They want you to come in and browse through them and try them. You don't see that in the chain stores. Typically, the chain stores focus their efforts on rapid turnover of the best sellers. And so when you go in, you see a rack. Here's the number one seller this week. Here's the number two seller. And they discount them deeply. If you can tell me how many square feet are in the chain store near your house, I can tell you within 4 or 5% what titles will be stocked on a shelf. So we get much more concentration of demand on a few titles. The advertising and promotion budgets are now being funneled accordingly onto those titles. And we see an enormous increase in the concentration of earnings by the players in the market who ultimately are responsible for which books sell and which ones don't, namely the authors. Prior to the mid-80s, a hardcover novel released in the United States never commanded a large advance payment. It was always the tradition in the industry that authors would stay with their publishers for virtually their whole career. They would have editors that they would work with again and again, and the novel would be brought out. If it succeeded, if it became a bestseller, then they would shop the title to the paperback houses, and those auctions would often culminate in a huge fee. But if the book succeeded, the author earned royalties in hardback, and the royalty rate wasn't any different for the authors that sold a lot than from those who sold only a few, and there was effective cross-subsidy from the best-selling books to the books in the mid and the bottom of the list. This didn't make any sense from the perspective of evolutionarily stable strategy. If you've got authors, some of them who are regularly producing books that sell 300,000 or 400,000 copies, there's cash on the table here. An agent can say, look, if you hire my client has produced a string of bestsellers. In all odds, he's going to produce yet another bestseller the next time out. If you don't give him a big advance, we're going to switch to another publisher. And so James Clavell, who had a string of best-selling novels, Shogun, King Rat, Taipan, all of which had sold hundreds of thousands of copies, his agent shopped two chapters, partly drafted, of his next novel, Whirlwind. It wasn't completed. They had no manuscript really to show people. And lo and behold, publishers bid $5 million for the right to publish the manuscript, the first seven-figure advance ever paid to a hardcover author, and for a book not yet written. The commentary in the press at the time was, this is crazy, the industry is going to go down the toilet, there's no way they can sustain sums like that. In fact, the book went on to spend 4 months on the New York Times bestseller list. It was a whole 4 or 5 weeks at number one. It earned out. It was a no-brainer. It was very easy to see how this contract made sense from the perspective of the people who signed on. Stephen King, another person who wrote reliably best-selling novels in the United States, signed a contract with not a word written of his next four books, merely the promise to write them for NAL Viking. He was paid some $40 million for the next four books. Danielle Steele, that same year, signed a contract for $60 million for her next five books, $12 million a book. Not a word yet written. And sure enough, I've watched since then. They've come out at regular intervals, and they're stacked up in the bookstores. They're up near the top of the bestseller lists on the Times and other lists. The publishers have not lost their shirts offering these contracts. When they decide which books to promote, they focus now much more on those handful of titles at the top than they do on the mid-list books. So when you look for the full-page ads, they're for the books that the publishers expect to become best-selling titles. So I mentioned the example of a book published in the U.S. a few years ago called How to Marry the Man of Your Choice. It was published with a money-back guarantee. The publisher offer to give you your purchase price back if in 3 years' time from buying the book you didn't get married, then you could just bring in the receipt and they'd buy the book back from you. There's all sorts of gimmicks and ads and other things focused on the titles they think have the potential to break out and become blockbusters. Very little effort to promote those titles that seem quite unlikely to become blockbusters. And then just one final point, even among those at the top, so here's the analog to the college graduates versus the whole population, even among those at the top, there's very clear evidence of growing skewness in the distribution of reward. What we did was we looked at the number of this year's top five authors in terms of sales and went back 5 years earlier to see how many times they had been among the top 10 in those previous 5 years. In 1978, that happened for two of that year's top five authors. Michener had been on the list twice in the past 5 years, Sidney Sheldon once. By 1990, a dozen years later, all five of them had been on the list at least once during the past 5 years. Danielle Steele 8 times, Stephen King 7 times, and so on. So it's the same people coming back again and again, ringing up the same big sales. Concentration. John Grisham, in the spring of 1983, had the number one title on the New York Times hardcover list, the number one, two, and three bestsellers on the Times paperback list. He has about 70 million books in print now, $4 a book, roughly speaking, royalty rate. It's enormous rewards going to those at the top, even as the technology, in principle, makes it possible for us to have a more varied and diverse publishing industry in the sense that we can now bring a book to market with a smaller print run than ever before because of computerized typesetting. Still, the fact is, the resources in the industry aren't going towards those books with 400 print runs. They're going towards the books that sell hundreds of thousands of copies. In the chief executive arena, there's been an enormous increase in the pay of the top officers of the large American corporations, and I understand that phenomenon has begun to surface in the UK as well. Greif Crystal estimated that in 1974, the top officer of the corporation earned approximately 35 times as much as the average worker. By 1991, he had estimated the ratio at 120. There was a more recent study of the top 30 U.S. corporations. As of 1995, the chief executive's pay was 211 times the average worker's pay. So this is proceeding apace. CEO pay in the U.S. grew about 19 or 20% last year. The same year, worker compensation grew at the lowest rate it had grown in any year since World War II. Well, we claim that this is in part, at least, the result of the change in the degree to which the best performers affect the final outcome. If you think about CEO pay of $4 or $5 million dollars a year, £2 or £3 million a year, it seems like an exorbitant sum, but if you're talking about a corporation that has $8 or $10 billion worth of output flowing out of it, if you think about the chief executive making one or two or three small decisions better than the next best candidate for that position would have, then it's easy to see how the best, having the best player in that job could be worth not £4 million more than having the next best player, but perhaps a much larger sum. And so we've seen examples in which executives who have developed strong reputations for being able to turn troubled companies around have gotten even larger pay packages. The Eastman Kodak Company in the United States, which had lost $1.75 billion in the 9 months leading up to its reorganization, hired George Fisher, a man who had turned Motorola, the electronic giant, around. It had been struggling. He made it a very highly profitable and dynamic company. They brought him over to manage Kodak. They paid him $70 million, and he turned Kodak around. So from one perspective, it's an obscenely high salary. From the shareholders' perspective, indeed from the employees' perspective, who hope to maintain a job with Kodak, the company losing $1.75 billion wasn't a very good home before Fisher came in. It's a very good home for people to be now. So still there, a bargain. Looked at from the point of view of the individual actor, and again, as we'll see, my theme will eventually be that how things look to the individual actor are quite different from how they look when we stand back a pace and ask, how does this pattern look from the perspective of society as a whole. So the same Darwinian conflict between the individual and the species we'll see emerging clearly here in this arena as well. Now, you might object that this is a peculiarly U.S. phenomenon. Why is it happening now? Why weren't CEOs always paid such exorbitantly high salaries? Weren't the CEOs of the big companies important 40 years ago? Surely they were. They're more important now. That's part of the story. There are many more ways your company can go bankrupt now than before. General Motors in the United States kept on its payroll its CEO, Roger Smith, by all accounts the most lackluster executive among captains of industry in America. He was on their payroll as CEO for 11 years. Finally, they got rid of him. His next two successors lasted about a year each. Now, CEOs have a very short tenure if they don't deliver in the executive suite. The difference between then and now, I think, is that there is now an open market for CEOs. In the past, in the U.S., in order to become the CEO of a large corporation, you had to essentially rise from within the ranks of that company. That's still true in Germany. It's true as well in Japan. And that accounts, I believe, for why the ratios in Germany and Japan, CEO pay to worker pay, are so small compared to what they are in the U.S. and a lesser contrast, the U.K. 21 times as much in Germany, 16 times as much in Japan. Once an open market for executive talent develops in those countries, we expect to see the dike burst there as well. So when Japanese executives find themselves working in Ohio, managing the Toyota plant there, and the Ford executive doing the same thing is earning 10 or 15 or 20 times as much as that executive, it may occur, if he's a particularly talented executive, for Ford to send an emissary over to ask her out to lunch. She can come and talk about the possibility that she might accept a move from Toyota to Ford at a pay 10 times what she's earning now. She's already living in the U.S. after all, speaks English. These kinds of moves are beginning to occur. The ripple effects, once they begin to occur, tend to amplify very rapidly. In any kind of socially interdependent process like this, you see small changes in initial conditions, often spreading like prairie fires. The same forces that made the Eastern European governments fall so rapidly and unexpectedly in the late 80s are at work in arenas like this whenever there are interdependencies. I'll show you one example of it. I better watch my time. Alan, I've got until 6, have I?
5 past if you like.
Okay. In professional sports, there was an enormous increase in the leverage of the top performers that occurred during the 50s when television contracts began bringing in large extra revenues into the industry. So a baseball player once entertained several thousand people in the local stadium. With the introduction of the national TV contract, suddenly that same baseball player was putting smiles on the faces of millions of people, and so all the money that came in really represented an increase in that person's productivity. He was much more valuable than before. He was. There are no female baseball players yet in the United States. The salaries of baseball players had not moved one iota between 1950 and the middle of the 1970s, however, because there was not the other essential ingredient that this winner-take-all phenomenon needs in order to occur. There has to be, first of all, enormous leverage, small differences in talent giving rise to enormous differences in value, but there has to also be open competition for the services of the best players. And in professional sports, there were formal restrictions that prevented players from bargaining with one another's teams for the sale of their services. They could not leave their own team and go work for another team enter a bidding that has so enriched the executives. All that changed in 1975. There was a court decision that overturned that restriction on movement. And you can see earnings, the graph starts here in the mid-60s, but I could go all the way back to the 50s. In real terms, their earnings were just sort of scooting along constant. Suddenly, free agency becomes a realistic part of the institutional structure, and upslants that trajectory, and then new TV contracts are signed, more cash comes in. Immediately, it gets captured into the pockets of the inputs that really matter. In the publishing industry, it's the authors. In the sports industry, it's the players. Those inputs that, in the end, determine success or failure are the ones who end up capturing most of the rewards in these processes. So just as we've seen that process at work in sports, in management, it's now playing out in consulting. If your firm has the reputation for being the best consulting firm on a particular subject, you can name your price. If you're the best architect, you can name your price. There are clients who want the best architect, and who cares what the price is? Others further down in the queue may be nearly as talented and have very, very different results. Well, all right, what about the normative implications of all this? This is sort of the natural working out of what happens when individuals follow their interests as best they can, and we see certain outcomes under certain technical conditions. In the males competing for females example, the technological wrinkle that gave rise to the winner-take-all outcome was this curious fact that a small number of males could sire most of the offspring, given the mechanics of sexual reproduction. That meant that if there were some particularly well-qualified males, some who were intelligent, strong, disease-resistant, where's Jeffrey Miller, if they could do nice verses and dance gracefully in front of their partners they're trying to woo, why not concentrate all the reproductive effort on them, since they could supply in unlimited quantity what was really what you were after? So in species where monogamy has not yet been implemented as a way of sort of curbing that tendency to concentrate on a handful of winners, that was the source of the winner-take-all phenomenon there. It's given rise to by a variety of other things in the markets I'm talking about. Technologies that let the best performers clone their services would be sort of a cheap way to say it. Compact discs. We all have information now about who's best in the world. If you want to know which refrigerator to buy, it used to be there were 40 or 50 you could choose from. Now the rating systems come out each year, and there are really only a handful left to choose. If you're a tire producer in northern Ohio, you were once almost guaranteed of a brisk market in your local territory. Now you've got to be one of the two or three best tire producers worldwide, or else there's no market whatsoever for your services. Well, is this a good thing? Clearly, in the same sense that it's good for the characteristics of a species, if disease-resistant males father most of the offspring, it's a good thing for people if we all get to listen to a better singer rather than a worse singer. So there's that same kind of upside that occurs in the human process I'm describing, as there was in the non-human analog. There is, however, a very disturbing downside, quite apart from the growth in inequality, and that's disturbing aplenty. I mean, if you chart out the rate of change of income at the different points on the economic totem pole, you see a very troubled society, troubled indeed far beyond even the troubled society we see now, with those at the top having more and more command over the resources of society, those at the bottom having an ever more difficult struggle to buy the things that they need. And I was just reading an obituary of Stavros Niarchos, the Greek shipping magnate who had died a couple of weeks back. He and Onassis were two of the richest men on earth when Onassis was alive. They were embroiled in an enormous consumption arms race between them. Onassis built the yacht Christina. It was a 325-foot vessel. The bar stools in the bar were covered with the buttery soft, jarringly expensive leather from the scrotum of the sperm whale, this wonderfully scarce product. He had a swimming pool in the yacht that at the flip of a switch would be covered by a mosaic-tiled dance floor, not just any mosaic tile, but the very finest glazings to be found anywhere in the world. Niarchos was infuriated by this. He had a schooner. He gave instructions to his naval architect to build the grandest vessel of all, and specifically the one feature he insisted on was that it be 50 feet longer than the Onassis vessel. And so it was launched at 375 feet. It had all a treasure and art hanging in the stateroom walls. This all at the same time, people are eating cat food and dog food among the poor. It's the the social costs of this growing income inequality seem quite worth worrying about, but I don't know how it is in the UK. If you raise those issues in the United States, people tut-tut and say, a dreamer. He thinks we need to do something about the poor. Doesn't he understand the realities of the marketplace? The only hope for the poor is to have a buoyant economy, and that means essentially throwing the poor out on the street and urging them to fend for themselves. There was a wonderful New Yorker cartoon I clipped years and years ago. It was of a upper crust family driving through the Lower East Side of New York through the Bowery. There was a drunk sprawled in a door stoop, and the wife said to the husband driving the Lincoln Town Car, Otis, shout at that man to get himself together, as if somehow that was all it took. You could just make it happen. Just say no to that lifestyle that you have there. All right, so you can't talk about equity problems because you're thought to be a soft head in addition to a soft heart. Keep that person away from the senators. You'll have them sending the economy down the chutes. What Cook and I claim is that the winner-take-all payoff structure, because of this curious conflict between the interests of the individual and the group, gives rise not only to inequality in the market system that we have today, but also enormous waste and inefficiency. And that the wonderfully hopeful punchline that's going to come out of this story in 15 minutes' time is that we can raise the tax rates on the highest earners, those who've been doing the best in recent decades, and not only not compromise economic growth, but actually accelerate. So that's my claim. How can I defend that? Well, first I want to claim that there is overcrowding in winner-take-all markets, just as there are too many males in sexually reproducing species. Why is there overcrowding? Well, the first reason I want to invoke, I don't think has an analog in the animal case, although if it does, someone here will surely know of it. I want to point to a cognitive error, maybe I'll call it that. It's an error in any event that people seem prone to make when they're called upon to estimate how good they are at something relative to others. If you're going to become a contestant for an investment banking position, you know, there are a lot of other smart people trying to get that same job. If twice as many of you compete, there won't be twice as many openings. So you're really going to be spinning your wheels if you spend 4 years getting credentials and in the end discover that you didn't land that position. Then you've got to go and sell insurance or do something else that would be worse than what you could have done if you'd just not bothered with that at the outset. So what I claim is that when people sort of size that gamble up, they systematically tend to overestimate their chances of winning. We have just a whole library of data to sustain this claim. There are drivers who are surveyed, how good a driver are you, ma'am? And people are asked to rate their skills. Some 92% of all drivers say they're better than the median driver. Most strikingly, there was a sample of drivers recovering in hospital from injuries they'd sustained in accidents that they themselves had caused. They thought, a strong majority of them, thought they were much better than average drivers. College professors, even more, 94% of them thought that they were more productive than their median colleague. It's hard to find anyone who doesn't think that he gets along with others better than the average person. People think the economy is going to go down next year, but my income will go up. People think the odds of getting cancer are one in a million, but mine are one in a trillion. It's the same pattern again and again. Adam Smith remarked about it more than 200 years ago. The overweening conceit with which the greater part of men have of their own abilities, men or women have their own abilities, is an ancient evil remarked by the philosophers and moralists of all ages. Their absurd presumption, their own good fortune, has been less taken notice of. It is, however, if possible, still more universal. There's no man living who, when in tolerable health and spirits, has not some share of it. The chance of gain is by every man more or less overvalued, and by any man who is in tolerable health and spirits, valued more than it is worth. And Smith went on to say that worst of all, this bias comes at precisely, it's strongest at precisely the moment when people make their career choices. So we get too many contestants in winner-take-all markets, partly because people are naively optimistic about their chances of winning. But even if it weren't for that fact, even if the guidance counselors gave full warning and people took it to heart, there is still a structural problem, and I think here the mechanism I'll describe comes close to being precisely isomorphic. Actually, there aren't degrees of isomorphic. It's isomorphic to the mechanism I described in the case of the male-male competition example, and that is that we get too many males in species because when a parent's deciding metaphorically which offspring, the sex of an offspring to have, if it chooses a male in a population that has currently a minority of males, it doesn't worry about the fact that its male produce offspring that will become its grandchildren at the expense of some other male's grandchildren. So it takes into account the fact that its male children will produce offspring, and that's what it cares about. But each offspring that its male offspring produce as grandchildren simply mean, given the constraint of female reproductive capacity, that there'll be fewer grandchildren for other people who have male offspring. So it's this sense in which the opportunity to have a male is very attractive to the individual, but from the species perspective, the payoff is much, much smaller. Similarly, to the person who considers going into a winner-take-all market, the payoff is so large to becoming an investment banker that if I feel I have a shot, it's rational for me to become an investment banker. But what I don't take into account when I do that is that if I'm lucky enough to land that position, all that means really in the end is that someone else nearly as talented, maybe more talented than I, fails to land that same position. So it's this displacement phenomenon that each ignores. If the elasticity of high-ranked positions were one for one, if every time you double the number of people seeking these superstar positions, the number of superstar positions and the amount they pay people were to double as well, there wouldn't be this inefficiency. But they do not. They're more or less insensitive to the number of people seeking them. So when more people seek them, as they have been in recent years, what we have in effect is a larger army of wannabes at the margins who, as in the old acting pattern, they'd move to Hollywood, they'd wait tables, do taxi cabs for 10 or 15 years, and then finally grudgingly admit that they weren't going to become a movie star, go back and pick up as best they could. So in that sense, we have a tragedy of the commons. David Hull mentioned the tragedy of the commons. This is precisely a tragedy of the commons. It's an invisible hand of sorts. It's not doing good. It's making people send their ship out, even though their ship, if it collects anything, will be collecting things that would largely have been collected by others had they not gone out. Now, what's interesting and different about human societies and non-human societies is that we have at least the potential to be able to do something about the conflict between the individual and the group. If the elk could get together and have a town meeting and pass a resolution, or somebody would float a resolution that each of us cut back our rack of antlers by half, it would get an unanimous vote of approval. They would all immediately go out and do it, and they would be just as capable in their fights with one another as before, and they'd be better able to escape predators. But elks cannot do that. They have no practical mechanism for achieving that objective. Humans, however, can and do achieve agreements like that. We have military arms control agreements. We have, before talking about how we curb these agreements, let me say what other things we might try and curb. The rack of antlers parallel, that was the second form of waste I called your attention to in the male-male competition example. There's that same form of waste among competitors for these winner-take-all superstar positions. So if you're competing for a position on the starting line of a National Football League team, what's important to you is to be bigger and stronger and faster than the other people who are competing for the same position. The payoff to winning that position has grown a lot in the last years, and so has the size and strength and quickness of the people who've won the positions. I was astonished to hear during last year's championship game that the offensive linemen, the people in the front in the football game, who bump up against one another and try to clear the way for the people in the back to run through, the average weight of the starting six for the Dallas Cowboys was 333 pounds per person. 20 years ago, the starting weights for the same positions in the league averaged 270 pounds. So these men have been taking anabolic steroids. They've been eating 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 calories a day. They've been lifting weights 4 or 5 hours a day in the gymnasium, bulking up, thereby to improve themselves, to position themselves to get these positions. Collectively, there's no gain from that. You have 300-pounders bumping up against one another. That's not a more pleasurable game than when there were 270-pounders bumping up against one another. In fact, it's in many ways less pleasurable. The players that are interesting to watch are more often injured now than before because these big people are falling atop them. So look at investment bankers. Investment bankers and analysts spend endless hours and resources, computer time, theoretical skills, trying to come up with a way to predict 5 minutes in front of the next rival when a company's earnings are likely to shift away from the expected pattern. If you predict 5 minutes ahead of your rival, you make a fortune by trading on that information in the market before it's been capitalized into the values of the shares. If the same information were to be withheld for 2 weeks, the economy would function almost exactly as smoothly. But privately, the payoff to getting that information is so much higher than it is to society as a whole that we see this enormous expenditure of resources seeking the information. And so there are all these same forms of waste that are analogous to the rack of antlers of the elk, to the tusks of the walrus, to the raw sexual dimorphism of the elephant seal, this beast that weighs more than a big car. Why? Just because it needs to do battle with other beasts for access to food. All this waste is present in just the same ways. Unlike the animal species that can't come up with agreements to curb this waste, we, however, have a rich history of trying to do things about this. We have military arms race agreements. You'll see that as the same conflict as before between individual and group. We have school uniform requirements. This limits expenditures on clothing. Parents find that their sons and daughters are spending $200 on sneakers, thereby to seem fashionable. School uniform requirements limit that arms race. We have anti-steroid rules, which if they were perfect, would curb steroid use among athletes. And in fact, each time a new detection method is offered online, the athletes do turn away from steroids. The weightlifting competitions that have been held in the wake of a new steroid detection methods, typically the amount of weight that people try to lift is much lower than they'd lifted in the last competition. So there's clear evidence that if you could control it, people would want to control it and we would control it. We have, in England, I found a beautiful example of an arms control agreement, a literal arms control agreement, related to the practice of dueling, where apparently if someone in your peer group assaulted your honor in some way, offended your honor in some way, it was the custom to challenge that person to a duel. You'd show up at dawn, you'd have seconds, and there were some very clear rules of the encounter. You had to march off some number of paces before you turn and fire. Well, why not just turn and fire? If you turn and fire, you're both going to be killed almost surely. If you march off a certain number of paces and turn and fire, you defend your honor and you have at least a chance of surviving the encounter. There was a rule that said the barrel of your weapon couldn't be scored. It couldn't have the spiral grooves that make the bullet come out with a spin and fly more true. It had to be smooth, so the bullet would come out and flutter and be inaccurate. They wanted it to be inaccurate. They had a rule that the bullet, that the weapon could fire only a single shot. You imagine today's duelist facing off with 100-round assault white rifles. Each will go down for sure under the circumstances. And so they had cooked up a pretty good set of arms control agreements there that on one sample of 200 British duels kept the number of people who were even hit by their opponent's bullet down to 1 in 6, and the number of people who died only 1 in 14. And the analyst argued that even those numbers were gross overestimates because most of the duels that didn't result in anything never made it into the sample. Now, of course, we have a law that says you can't duel, even if somebody offends your honor. So I might say, well, that was a rude thing. I'd like to duel with you at dawn, but we can't, darn it. But be secretly gratified that we're not able to defend our honor in that way any longer. Among lawyers, there are these arms races that get out of control. If you're a contestant in a litigation It's very easy for each side to spend more and more trying to improve its chances of winning. Kenneth Boulding recognized this dilemma and proposed an agreement that I think he had no way of predicting 30 years ago how much people would be attracted to this proposal in the 1990s. He said, if, however, we could achieve a kind of intellectual disarmament and agree that nobody would be allowed in the legal profession with an IQ above 100, the result would be almost exactly similar. People would still try to buy the best lawyers they could, but a valuable intellectual resource would be economized. In the United States, enrollments in law have doubled in the last 20 years. Enrollments in engineering have been stagnant. Three economists in the United States produced a study in which they estimated that doubling enrollments in engineering makes national product grow by 0.5% more. Doubling enrollments in law makes growth go down by 0.3%. So now what we see is the best and the brightest of our students deserting careers like teaching, where the qualifications as measured by standardized test scores of entering teachers have fallen precipitously in the last 20 years. More and more of our best and brightest students seeking positions in law, in investment banking, in those careers where the beacon of these high salaries would draw them in. David Hall mentioned the doctors practicing defensively. It's pervaded really every arena of America. Now, season's greetings looks okay to me. Let's run it by the legal department. A company doesn't dare act now for fear that there will be some line it will cross that will result in lawsuit. It doesn't matter whether you've done it in good faith and whether it made sense. It goes in front of a jury, and then what they award is just you spin the wheel. You're not sure what's going to happen. And that, the lawyers get 30% of those multi-million dollar judgments. Indeed, $4 billion is the judgment that the lawyers who ran the class action suit on the breast implants have now 30% of to split among them. All right, so the solution that really stares us in the face that we've walked away from, because the right wing has really captured the rhetoric on this issue, is the whole problem's gotten worse because the prizes at the top have gotten bigger. It's as if we've gone from a monogamous species to a polygynous species, and suddenly the stakes in the reproductive competition have escalated. And so no wonder the males are getting bigger and fighting more viciously doing these things that are from a group perspective not productive. The very simplest thing to do would be to say, make the rewards at the top less attractive, thereby luring in fewer into the contest to occupy the top positions. And that can be done simply by raising the tax rate on the highest earnings. People will complain, that kills the goose that lays the golden egg. We don't dare do that. We'll destroy economic growth. This Don Riley drawing from the New Yorker, I think, captures perfectly the supply-siders' view of the incentive system. If those rich birds get their way, I can tell you, here's one coolie who will stop putting his goddamn shoulder to the goddamn wheel. The CEOs are just poised on the knife edge. Once the tax rates go up just a little bit, they're out and they're into the pool drinking their martinis. Why should they be paying attention to what's in the shareholders' interest at that point if they're going to have to pay 41% tax rather than 39% tax? Look, Japanese tax rates are much higher, German tax rates are much higher, your tax rates at the margin are the same as in the U.S. now, they used to be much higher. You have a value-added tax in addition, so I guess on balance they're much higher. But all the data now seem to show that there's no reduction in effort if your tax rates aren't the highest in the world, and so you're scaring people off into other countries. Short of that constraint, if you have higher tax rates than you have now, The vice presidents aren't going to stop trying to be CEOs. Tim Hinman's going to still try to win Wimbledon. It's not going to be all over in this competition. But those who were on the margins, those who were just sort of poised between teaching and becoming a lawyer, and now see that the prize at the top in after-tax terms is a little less lustrous than before, might instead make a different career choice. And if they did, then we'd get output from those people instead of one more lawyer chasing after the ambulance. And so the rate of growth of income would be higher under those circumstances rather than lower. So I think it's really an unproved proposition, to put it charitably, that the negative relationship between taxes on the top earners and growth is so. Probably it's just the opposite. So I'll stop with that
at just the appointed time. And
I think there's some hope. I mean, I agree, it won't be an easy struggle, but it's easier if you think the economy will grow faster than if you think the economy will go into a slide to talk about higher taxes. What Cook and I actually propose is not an increase in income tax, but rather an abandonment altogether of taxation of income in favor of a progressive tax on consumption. So you would take, I'll show you how it would work. You would take the amount of income you have now and pay tax on, just the way the current system works, and you would deduct from that a standard deduction, just like we do now, but that's not going to work. You'd also deduct your savings. So you could have a progressive consumption tax by calculating income just as you do now for the government. Take your standard deduction off. We have that now. And then take off however much money you put into a savings account. You'd need a bookkeeping mechanism to do that. And the tax you pay would come off the top too. And so then, if the standard deduction, I've got all this in dollars. I'm sorry I didn't change it to pounds, but you could just imagine a similar system. The first, you could consume quite a lot without owing any tax at all, and then for everything above a certain threshold, you'd pay tax, say 20% on the next dollars or pounds, and 22%, and it could escalate on up, and could escalate actually to a fairly high level. And you could have a much higher rate at the top if you taxed only consumption, because I think the effect would be to make people consume less lavishly. At the top, and hence filtering back down the chain less lavishly all the way down. I mean, Niarchos would have needed only a 200-foot yacht to best his rival if we'd had a steep consumption tax. And people would say, well, the rich won't even pay any attention to a steep consumption tax. Bill Gates right now is just about to move into a 50,000-square-foot house in Seattle. 50,000-square-foot house is bigger by a factor of two than any other chief executive house I'm aware of. And I think The logic there is clear. Gates is a captain among captains of industry. He needs a 50,000 square foot house because the ordinary captains of industry have a 25,000 square foot house. People in New York, many of them wealthy as the people who have 25,000 square foot houses in LA and Seattle, have 5,000 square foot houses. Why? Because real estate's so expensive in New York. So the rich, even though they could buy big houses in New York, don't. If Bill Gates moved to New York, he wouldn't build a 50,000 square foot house there. He could have an imposing house in New York if he had a 10,000 square foot house. So you'd see this gradual de-escalation, and with no psychological cost whatsoever to the people who were cutting from 50,000 to 25,000 square foot houses. You can still have plenty of room to store your books and shirts in a 25,000 square foot house, and it would be a lot easier. I mean, you need fewer staff, you have fewer people interrupting you and underfoot. It would just be better if you had a 25,000 square foot house and everyone else had a 12,000 square foot house than to be in the current arrangement where we've got ones twice that big. So if I were a politician, I think it'd be kind of tempting to propose a tax like that. No one's going to worry that Bill Gates is going to have to buy a 25,000 square foot house instead of a 50,000 square foot house. And people would sort of discover that as those spending levels at the top went down, spending levels at the next level would go down. And so someone in the middle today who feels he must have a 4,000 square foot house might discover that life can be lived in a satisfying way in a 3,000 square foot house. Surprise. I lived for 2 years in Nepal as a Peace Corps volunteer. I lived in conditions that I won't describe in detail, but if an American lived under such conditions, she would feel bitterly impoverished. I felt a little surprised at first at the conditions, but after a few weeks' time at most, they just seemed utterly normal, and I had a $40 a month income, which was more than most other people had in my village, and I have to say I felt prosperous during that period to a degree that was well beyond what I've experienced, except only maybe just recently, as my income's grown a little here. So it's really not hard to consume less when everyone consumes less. And I think there's cash on the table here. There's trillions of pounds of cash on the table. So you're right, it's hard to raise taxes, but the argument's so compelling to raise them in this form that I have to be optimistic and think someone's going to try it. And if it works, as you say, that people stumble all over themselves to copy what works. So, maybe your country or mine won't be the first one to try it, but maybe some country will give it a roll.
I'm Larry Samuelson from the University of Wisconsin. You said a great deal when you talked about technology, putting lots of cash on the table, the phrase was, but much less about the market structure that lets a few people capture that cash. For example, when you talked about Captain Battle, the suggestion was that the small number of recording firms can't avoid the ruinous auction for her services that translates the spoils of that market to her. Yet when mentioning tax software, the two firms in that market get huge rents because they do avoid a similar ruinous auction that would transfer those rents to consumers. You talked about the market for CEOs opening up. This also strikes me as something that could cut both ways. This gives the CEO the option of auctioning himself to other firms, but also firms other options for hiring CEOs that may not have been there in the past. Mm-hmm. It's not clear in each case why the market structure works with the rents where they are. I could see if we have a best person in the market that they should be able to capture the rest over the second best.
Yes.
But there aren't many markets around like basketball where we all know that Michael Jordan is the best. As you said, what we typically have is a few best, and we typically have a few on each side of this market. What this technology's done is produced thin markets for us. And one side of this market can often dissipate the rents by passing it on to consumers. Yeah. What's changed in the market structure of the economy that stops these rents amongst the few people on one side instead of dissipating them?
See, in the CEO market, what seems to have changed fundamentally is this notion that you can recruit from only a limited pool to fill your CEO position. When Apple hired Scully back in '83,
eyebrows went up across the business community. What were they doing hiring a soft drink guy to sell computers? And maybe that, in hindsight, was a good question to be asking, but whatever the merit of that, the idea that you need somebody steeped in the details of your industry to run your company now is a fallen idea, basically. There's such a thing in the minds of the captains of industry that there are talents that are effective in virtually every arena. And so you need to motivate people. You need to know how to raise money. You need to know how to market. Certain of those skills are general rather than specific. And so I don't think it's possible if there's an egregiously talented CEO for the fact that there are only three car companies any longer to be a barrier to him getting the rent from being such a talented CEO. And
if we expand the pool of which firms will hire CEOs,
No, I think what will happen is we'll see an assignment where the most important job gets filled by the most able person, the next most important job gets filled by the next most able person, and the stakes are such that small differences are going to result in big salaries. You know, their rent won't be the full amount they contribute, it'll be the difference between what they produce and what the next best guy would produce. That's right. But still a big number.
Next question, please.
Richard Wilkinson, Sussex. I'm happy with most of your analysis, but it seems to me you're suggesting that there are a number of quite independent mechanisms that have come together to create this winner-take-all, or strengthen the winner-take-all market situation. I mean, you suggest technology with the music industry. Technology is obviously the explanation also in software, Bill Gates. But in the chief executive officers, you talk about the open markets and baseball also, free agency.
Well, it's technology there too, though, the television revenues.
Okay, but, and I guess in publishing, example, you talked about the hype and so on, an explanation of that. I feel there's a problem that you're suggesting a number of apparently independent things have just come along at the same time, producing the situation. An alternative would be, you could say, okay, there have been some changes that are based on technology or whatever, but there are others. It seems to me you have to have a space for ideology in your picture. I remember hearing not long ago the Japanese expert Ron Dorr talking about how in recession some Japanese directors would expect to take pay cuts rather than lay people off in their firms. That's clearly a moral position, and we're aware of the absence of that, and maybe it's appearing in Japan. So there are clearly moral things, and we never know how much of what we call market pressures and supply and demands and demand is influenced by similar conceptions. But we do know in the rise of monetarism and the Reagan Thatcher period that there was a much broader picture of promotion of some of the things to do with individual monetary incentives and so on, weakening of the power of labor. But even if you ignore that element, that ideological element in it, and also the political impact of weakening bargaining power, I would have thought you would need to argue that, okay, in music or, for instance, in baseball, and to argue that maybe one can say that technology there too is an element, you would have to argue that those inequalities were socially generalized through various social and ideological pressures, so other people would also want equally high rewards in other industries. Mm-hmm. And then your explanations would go into reverse. Because you'd be saying, okay, in order to get the chief executives having to pay so much, and that means that they have to structure the work and the use of these people, use of the lawyers in your one of your examples, quite differently. You're having to pay them so much, so the way they work must also change to fit in with that. So I'm not quite sure about your lack of any reference to ideology, and also whether the explanation always works the way around you're saying. It seems to me sometimes inequality goes to causes the change in the working capital.
Yeah, I have no sense of how the CEO's day has changed now versus 25 years ago. Just my casual sense is that those people worked very hard then, you know, that there were very sought after positions then, and they work hard now. They probably work harder now because it's easier to lose those positions now. So if there's any change there, it is in the direction of demanding more from the incumbents in those jobs than we used to, yes. Sure, ideology matters. There was resistance to the early increases in CEO pay. They drew a lot of fire in the press. They're beginning to generate sort of organized movements politically now to try and curb them. And I think, you know, it's too early to see where that goes, but I think the people who are trying to roll them back by urging companies to use moral restraint in the amounts they pay their CEOs are probably not going to end up making much difference in the end. I think if you're a company that's in trouble, as Apple is, then you bid for Gil Amelio, the one person positioned who might make a difference in the fate of that company, and you pay him $10 million to run your company each year, even though the company's laying people off. It lost $70 million in December. Posted a $700 million loss in the first quarter of this year. Still are paying the CEO $10 million. And if you're a shareholder or an employee, you'd feel bad if, you know, they had reached a different judgment. If they'd said, morally, we can't do this, we're only going to pay $400,000, and then they got somebody who they could get for that price, and the company, you know, went on its way down the chute.
First question for Pat. This is Gideon, non-economist, that's the very last question. You said that, if I understood you right, you were suggesting that a progressive tax on consumption would improve productivity. What I understand is if people are consuming less, where is the market going for the stuff that is being produced?
Well, you have income, you can dispose of it in two ways. You can consume it or save it. The other side of that is the expenditure side. Income can be spent in two ways. It can be spent on consumption goods or on investment goods. So the change that would occur would be to have fewer resources devoted to consumption goods, more resources devoted to investment goods. So you still have full employment. You may have different kinds of consumption goods. You have carpenters building many small houses rather than a few big ones. The kind of cars you'd build might be different, but there's no need, given what we know now about demand management, to have an economy that would be less than fully employed on that account. You know, we can invest, take the earnings from the investment, and in fact, this is such a strong possibility. I'll show you what would happen in a very short period of time if you changed your consumption pattern from 5% of your income being saved to 20% of your income being saved. If you could invest your money at 10%, here's the society consuming 95% of its income and how its consumption grows over time as the interest accumulates on its savings. If you consume 80% of your income, in other words, save 20%, you take a big hit right up front. You consume less than you are now by a substantial margin, but then the extra money you save is earning 10% interest. That's added on to your income. You're consuming 80% of that extra income. Within 11 years' time, your consumption path crosses the old consumption path. And forever after, you have more consumption than before. So, I don't know, maybe you can't earn 10% in the global equities market. It might be less than that. Or maybe you can save more than 20%, in which case might happen more quickly than that. But it wouldn't be a permanent reduction in the amount of resources even devoted to consumption if you increase savings by a large amount.
Jeffrey Miller, LSE. You made an illuminating analogy between sexual and economic winner-take-all contests. But in people, these two processes actually interact in complex ways that might limit the effectiveness of a consumption tax in eliminating the costs and the overcrowding. For example, real payoff to a basketball player like Wilt Chamberlain, the poor free agency, was not so much the monetary pay, but the 40,000 rupees that he claimed to have had sex with. And as long as people are still getting status and fame and sexual access and rupees from being the winner that takes all, they won't really care about the consumption. And second, a lot of mate choice happens when people are educating themselves for these roles. The fact that you're in law school is itself a draw, regardless of whether you go on to become the top Wall Street lawyer. And by the time you fail to become the top Wall Street lawyer, you're already married.
That means she'll stay with you. I think it's surely correct that there would be lots of really talented people struggling for the positions in the National Basketball Association in industry, even if the pay were quite low, because there are so many non-monetary rewards that accompany them. What we know, though, is that the number of people who are seeking those positions has exploded in the last 25 years. And I think, I mean, that's a complicated interplay between the extra money that the positions command and maybe you would want to say the extra status that they command on account of there being extra money. If the after-tax reward from the positions were lower, then that would at least push you in the right direction. I mean, there are some people who've joined that competition apparently in response to the changes in reward that have occurred in the last 25 years. So I don't want to say you're going to scare everybody out. We don't want to scare everybody out. You know, we still want Michael Jordan in the NBA. We want Kathleen Battle to be recorded. And I guess if you make the rewards lower, there's some risk that you'll drive a Kathleen Battle out. I mean, that's a risk.
Gary, from Cambridge. There's another New Yorker cartoon, I remember, where the rich man winds down the window and says to the fellow in the gutter, get out there and inherit a hardware business like I did. You haven't said anything about capital. You talked about human capital, but not the real capital. And it seems to be one of the problems you've got. As long as you have family structures, and this interacts again, you could get biological, isn't it, if you feel like it. But short of imposing kibbutzim or some fairly extreme situations, you're going to, I assume, have people who want whatever they've got to be theirs to transmit to their heirs, and those heirs are going to start with differential advantage. And in your world, where there's 10% return on global equities, and people are going to say, we are going to be back to the normal state of any free functioning capitalist economy. And our old friend, the great distribution of the high upper tail, and the Gini coefficient way up and whatever it is, and there's a theoretical argument, some people starting with Frank Hahn, but I'm sure they develop more skills than I do, the distinction between income and wealth is artificial anyway. You want some measure of the economic power that people have. So you've got another huge problem, I think, which you need to address, haven't you? To achieve your political end.
You mean that the progressive consumption tax would lead to a concentration of wealth?
Yes, I mean, you will have to tax inherited capital effectively, won't you, to reduce inequality in the distribution of what there is,
yes,
the goods and services and the access to them.
We do that now.
You talked purely about, yes.
Yeah, I assume we would.
Huge concentrations, does it? I mean, what's the solution to that?
Yeah, I think that we might see an enormous increase in the concentration of portfolio values occurring in response to a highly progressive consumption tax. It really would make for a much stronger incentive to put money away rather than spend it. And, you know, we do tax inheritances now in the United States. I don't know what your policy is here, but that would be something on the table for discussion with any tax reform proposal. I mean, if it could be shown that intergenerational transmission of wealth threatened to create power imbalances that would sort of lead political campaigns into a bad new path and distribute power in society in ways that we wouldn't like, then we could certainly imagine addressing that through inheritance taxes. Sure, it would be something we'd have to think about. Sure.
Matt,
I've
read that particular video. An illuminating example of what you're talking about, where in a sense it has been done. Our market, but our similar market somewhere else. yes. For example, within one country without having an agreement with other countries that they were opposed to that. Already a lot of the best CEOs moved quite freely between Britain and America, certainly, right. Between other countries, which would surely make it very difficult, particularly in arts and entertainment, things like
yes.
How would you deal with international?
Yeah, I think I focus less on that issue than people here seem inclined to do, simply because our tax rates in total are so far below the tax rates of any other industrial country that we don't confront that question with the same urgency that you do here. But even you, don't you have the lowest income tax rates in the EU?
Yes. Yeah.
It doesn't seem like... What's that?
The worst government.
There may be a link. Yeah, I think you've got some room to maneuver before you run up against the wall of that constraint. But in the end, of course, if it were the ideal solution to this problem to have a 90% tax on consumption at the very highest levels, one country acting alone couldn't do that. You'd need some sort of concerted action to do that. And whether you could ever achieve that through such institutions as we now have, I very seriously doubt. We might need, I mean, lots of reasons we're going to need a broader governing body in the future. I mean, if it really does turn out to be a problem that dumping greenhouse gases into the air is going to kill us, then, you know, one country can't solve that problem. I mean, there are lots of cases where we know we need a broader jurisdiction to solve it.
Just a very simple question, what time of where they see. For you, what would be the optimum Gini coefficient in your ideal economy? I'm just talking about inequality and inequality without the actual Gini inequality.
Oh, I mean, I wouldn't have any idea what sort of number to rattle off, but what's especially interesting to see now is the research that's emerging to the effect that, and Roger Wilkinson, I think you've got, you might be able to respond more intelligently to this question than I possibly could, but in societies, I gather, according to the research you've surveyed, that have lower disparities between rich and poor, the health levels in those societies are generally much, much better than in societies with extreme variations in wealth, and it even seems to be true that the rich are more healthy in societies where there are lower income disparity. So it may be that in a society where you're rich, far beyond the means of the average person, you're the object of resentment, and people scratch their keys along your Mercedes when they walk by. In a society where you're only marginally ahead of those behind you, you're the object of esteem, and people consult you for your opinion, and you have a very different view of what it's like to be alive, perhaps. So I think when you think about it in the abstract, I think people overestimate what a great thing it would be to be much richer than everyone else. It's probably in terms of the resulting human satisfaction that would emerge from your situation, you'd be better off if you weren't that much.
Policy maker would want to be some targets looking towards.
Yeah. Well, if suddenly there's a groundswell of interest in that, I'll start thinking seriously about coming up with a number. But I've got a number.
Two more questions. Huh?
Yeah, you made the main analogy between the sort of new winner-takes all, where Peter starts with UCL, between sort of winner-takes all and economic effects and equal reproductive success in males, and that leads to focus on, if you like, the unfairness of the winner-takes-all effect. It occurs to me that a different ecological analogy might also be possible. That's what's known as the competitor exclusion principle, which says that you can't have more than two species in the same niche. And you can think of the winner-takes-all effect alternatively as an example of something where many niches are being knocked together.
Yes.
So think of your opera cast example. You originally have several local niches.
Yes, exactly.
They're all knocked together into one global niche. And so you get one best right. Dominated. And if you were to pursue this alternative analogy, mm-hmm. would suggest different concerns, such as loss of diversity.
Yes.
In that example.
Yes. Yeah, no, there's nothing in my mechanism to even focus on whether diversity is a good thing or a bad thing. That's right. Yeah, no, that's a very fruitful comment.
Yes. I'm
worried.
You're Professor Zeidman as well, are you?
I'm retired.
Surely, this is the sort of question which Karl Marx addressed himself more than 150 years ago. That was to say, the inequality, and inequities associated with the inequality. He said revolution. Fortunately, in some countries, and particularly this one, and indeed people associated with this institution, the founders of this institution, were the sort of people who said, for God's sake, tax the rich, tax their inheritances, tax their inequalities, redistribute it, and stop this dangerous nonsense. Now, he said to me that, you know, the inequalities that you're talking about here, as you're talking about them, said they're something novel, something that's only occurred in the last 50 years. A 50,000 square foot house is as nothing to an 18th century nobleman's mansion. I don't know, but you've been around in this country and seen this sort of thing. What happens to those savings? They get accumulated and put into those things and passed on, unless you have very strong inheritance laws. I mean, this is about political economy, not economic, but political economy. And the only way you can deal with this is a political type of solution. And for that, you go back and read, first of all, Karl Marx. Maybe read Thorsten Veblen. Maybe there are a whole, I would read Bernard Shaw. I mean, there are a whole lot of people who have over in our tradition, our intellectual and economic and political tradition is one which says this is the sort of thing for which there are ways of dealing. The whole argument about them, income tax is not an immoral thing, as the nobleman of the 19th century said. Three pence in the pound income tax and the country will be ruined, they said. And things like that. All of this argument goes over it again. And I'm astonished that it's necessary to rediscover in the end of the 20th century that thing about human societies and their human beings. Honestly, I really can't understand it in this building.
I said that's the last question, but I'm going to let Frank Hahn have a word now.
Just provoked me with a rejection. You must be continuously to our speaker, because he had a problem. It was not high inequality, but increasing. Now, the figure he gave, Karl Marx said, wrong inequality, not the wrong inequality about the 18th century, no doubt, or the Middle Ages. But at the moment, there are concrete questions to ask. Why is it that inequality has been increasing over the last 30, 40 years?
Because we have not played the right political game in relation to the country, so on, in the late context. And to be careful by economists to talk the wrong sort of thing. Indeed, that idea of
perhaps. This is better discussion to continue on the drinks, to which you are all invited in a moment. But first I would like to present our speaker, as is the tradition at Darwin Seminars, I understand, with present, which consists of, again, a book called Bright Paradise, about Victorian scientific travellers by Peter Raby, and another signed copy of the modest volume In the Blood, God, Genes and Destiny, by Steve Jones, both the gift of the publisher. Thank you very much for such a stimulating talk.